on the down low. Silver Room owner and operator Eric Williams. Chicago Bear great Doug Blank. And live music in Studio 435 from Los Shut Up. And now, here's your host, a man who had a better halftime adjustment than the Bears, Justin Kaufman.
I did. I went from taco dip to guacamole. It was a real simple adjustment. I realized the taco dip wasn't working like I thought it was going to be. I saw what my stomach could handle, and I switched to guacamole. Strong choice. Strong, always strong. And you know, I need to up my snack game. Like yesterday, I got really excited because I went to the store and I was like, okay, I'm going to go to the Jewel, and I went with a summer sausage, a cheese cracker, a taco dip, guacamole, and a French onion dip combo. Strong, right? Nothing of substance. Nothing that that I felt really showed the passion and the heart of a fan. Like I didn't use the oven. I needed to use the grill or the oven. And I feel like that. I'll come right out with it. I feel partially responsible for yesterday's loss.
What's summer sausage?
You know, like a summer sausage, like a big summer sausage. You know, like a round. It's like a round thing you get in the you don't get it like from the butcher. You just get it like, you know, like almost like.
It's like, you know, like salami or something you cut up. Yeah. I see. Yeah, so it's
It's not as fancy as your salamis, Pete, that you like so much with your artisan friends. But for me. You know, it's just a good old summer sausage. I just feel like my snack game was parallel to the Bears' performance. It was strong at the top. It was organized well, you know, for the first day. It had the right kind of combo. But as it went along, and as we got past the scripted part of the snacking, I was in no man's land where I started to go to a potato chip into the taco dip or a cracker with cheese, and then maybe I'll put this into the guacamole. It was just everything it was very similar to what was happening. A lot of three and outs.
Both sides.
A lot of rookie mistakes. And that's, I think, the takeaway from yesterday's loss was that I need to do a better job with the snacks.
It's early. First game. We improve.
You said on Friday that you were working at the Renegade Craft Fair and you were going to tape the game and you were going to try to avoid any spoilers. Were you able, Pete Zimmerman, to avoid spoilers?
I was not.
What happens?
Well, in previous years, this craft fair is on Division Street, and Division Street in like
famous,
Bucktown,
yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
You know, bars all over the place.
So it's hard because people scream and yell outside, right?
So last year we were facing north, where there's bars, but there's nothing really in front of us. This time we were facing south, so we were looking right at two bars, and they have TVs outside because they have patios. So essentially I was kind of able to watch the game from my perch.
So you made a choice early on to say, you know what, I'm sitting here, I'm just going to watch this game from afar.
You could not avoid it in that. And it was good because I actually... The bar that we were directly in front of was 10 seconds behind the bar that was a little further away. So you would hear.
And then you could switch.
So then I could look over and look at the TV to see what people were cheering about.
Not a bad invention, if you think about it. What if you were able to have two TVs in a house 10 seconds apart on delay for live sports and live events? So if you're watching something and you wanted to quickly see. What happened? You just I guess you got DVR for that. You can just rewind.
Yeah. But it was nice.
Okay, sorry.
It was nice
that was
to
an
have
idea
that
was great, like in 1988. I just threw a 1988 idea at you. Welcome to the download here. Right? Welcome to the download here. Wally Phillips coming up next here. I need to think about my technology. They're already past my ideas. 15 minutes behind my time. Got to work on that. All right, I will. I know it's Monday. It's a new week. I got to work. I just got to be stronger. I got to work harder. I bought new plants. I know that was a bad sequitur, but I went to Home Depot yesterday, and I was suckered into one more time buying two new plants that I would put in my yard that were more fall-oriented for the color. They were
great.
Yellows and darker. And I took to heart everything everyone said here. I put them in. I have started the process of staking around the plants. I sprayed it with that deer pee that everyone told me to get. And we'll see what happens. They're still around. I forgot to tell you that on this weekend I woke up Saturday morning and a complete hosta plant. And a hosta plant is like the green leaf plant. It's a big plant. Mm-hmm. It's not the kind of plant that has flowers around it. It's just the green leaves are the flowers. And I have a whole row of those by my front gate. A complete hosta was destroyed. Like, eaten to the core. Like, not like these rabbits are hungry.
Mm-hmm.
Eaten to the core. And not only that, Pete, and this is what drives me crazy about these rabbits. The ones that I let stay in my yard, the ones that I let the mom feed and nurture.
Yeah.
And I said, you know what? We can all live together in one ecosystem. Together, man and rabbit. They not only eat it, destroy it, you know, just ugly. They then decide that this would make a good place for their bathroom.
Right.
Oof. And so they do exactly what their mom did not teach them. They poop where they eat. I don't want a tenant that poops where they eat. You know, there's like little things I'll get away with. You know, like I'll say, okay, rabbits, you know, this is too much. You're creating anarchy in my yard. But you know what? I have to be a man of principle and integrity, and I have to say I don't like when people poop where they eat.
Mm-hmm.
This rabbit pooped where he ate.
You're out.
Now it's going to get awkward. I got to go talk to the guy tomorrow, the little rabbit, and we got to have a conversation that says you're not allowed anymore in my yard.
Yeah, they're boundaries.
Yeah. I mean, just be cool.
You had it.
Your brothers and sisters, they've taken off. There's only one or maybe two that are hanging out in my yard still. Like they're the children that stay after college, come back. You know what I mean? The other guys are like, let's hit that park. Let's see what that park's got to offer. This one guy's like, I think I'll stay. Let's put my headphones on, listen to some podcasts. So that's who I have in my yard right now. And obviously, this may be one of the slower rabbits. Let's just be honest. Maybe he doesn't understand that you don't poop where you eat. You know, as also don't stay in the yard you were born in. I think that's an old saying, too.
Mm-hmm.
Don't stay in the yard you were born in.
It is.
It's an old saying. Yeah, it's an old Aesop fable.
So despite this all happening,
you
decided to plant new flowers.
I did. It's not really plant. I just took one, like two planted plants. You know, like, I didn't really dig anything. I just put them in there. And they're nice. And one of them is mums. And supposedly, they're not supposed to eat mums. That they don't like them. But I read online, in parentheses, after every time somebody said they don't like mums, not guaranteed. Meaning the crappier rabbit's going to eat the mum, right? And I feel like if I've got one who doesn't understand that you don't poop where you eat, he's going to be like, mums, don't care. Eat them. Love them. I have 630 said, did you sprinkle with the pepper? Yes, I did. Everyone's saying that's what you're supposed to do.
You're following all the correct steps.
But remember what Jacob told us from Botanic Gardens. He's like, once they get the taste for it in their mouth, they don't care if you spread it with pepper or whatever because they remember the taste. They don't care. You have to almost at the beginning of the season in the spring you have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, But I've decided, you know. I'm not going to let the terrorists win, rabbits win. I'm not going to let the rabbits win.
Mm-hmm.
I can't let them win, right? Because if I decided that space where the hosta was just stayed empty, and I decided that the place where the hydrangea was stayed empty and where the other plant was stayed empty, then what would I have? I'd have nothing. I'd have nothing in my yard. So you know what? I'm not putting up with that. This aggression will not stand. So I got to have that conversation with the rabbit tomorrow. Not looking forward to it, me and him. News, weather, and traffic tonight with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. We got a great show tonight. Eric Williams is here from the Silver Room. Also tonight, Doug Plank's here to talk about the Bears breakdown. Also tonight, live in Studio 435, the band Low Shut Up with a reunion. Nice name. I love that name. Chris Churchill, Tony Mendoza. We will have them in studio tonight performing. We got a great show. Touche coming up a little bit after the news here at 7:30. It's a download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, so download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Why don't we kick off the show like we kick off every show with the carryout? This is, of course, our nightly segment where I read the news. So you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Hillary Clinton is said to be recuperating after yesterday's near collapse at a 9/11 remembrance in New York. Her doctor and the campaign have come out and said that she was diagnosed with Benghazi. Oh, I'm sorry, I read that wrong. Pneumonia. It's a silent P, I see. She was supposed to take it easy after being put on antibiotics. She didn't because she's running for president, and now conspiracy theorists around the country are in full I told you so mode. Pundits are asking for her to release her medical records to prove her healthiness. Is that a, that's a word, right? Yeah. Okay. So now we want to know who she's talked to, what she's written in her emails, and what she's gone to the doctor for. Hey, listen, tax returns, one thing. They show if you're doing something nefarious or whether or not you're mixed up with the wrong kind of money, which, well, if I think about it, I guess a health report would show the same thing. So, you know what? Release the dogs! I mean, the report! Release the report! In other news, Black China released her sonogram, so at least there's precedent, right? Come on, Hillary. Black China did it. Well, after this weekend, Chicago should release its health report. 2016 has seen over 3,000 Chicagoans shot. Over 3,000. That's almost 400 a month. In stark contrast, Chicago's reporting that tourism, at the same time, way up. So nothing to see here, folks. Garrett's popcorn, 67 cents today. Carry on. Wrigley tickets, expensive, but worth it. Carry on. Deep dish pizza, carry on. Enjoy Chicago. Mixed reviews for the big transportation experiment on the north side. Argyle Street has been renovated to let pedestrians, cyclists, and cars share the street. But drivers are reportedly confused on where to drive. Always a good thing. And local businesses have complained that people are avoiding the street because of said confusion. Hey, nobody said utopia would be perfect. All right, so suck it up. 15 arrested for stealing luxury cars in the suburbs. Hey, is this the same story that revealed that most of those cars were sitting in driveways with keys in the ignition? Let me guess, somebody locked their car doors and the crooks were stymied? They're like, that's it, I give up. I turned myself in, I can't get past this locked door. Give me a break. More crime news. Robbers in the South Loop are allegedly technologically savvy. They're robbing people at gunpoint and telling victims to unlock their phones and reset it to factory settings. I hope there's a Wi-Fi in the South Loop because that could take a while just on the regular network. If it's on an LTE, it's just slower. Then I'm just trying to help out the robbers. Like, she really should do an upgrade on Wi-Fi. Okay. Can you hit preferences? Hit tools? Anything change? In weather today, hot. Supposed to go down to 70, though, by midweek. That's when I break out the old Georgetown Hoya starter's jacket. I think Pete Zimmerman sold me that when he worked at Foot Locker. In sports, the Bears lost yesterday in a pretty miserable fashion, too. After surprising everyone with a competent first half, the Bears broke down in the second. The Texans rattled off 13 unanswered and beat the Bears on both sides of the ball. Cutler was harassed pretty much every play, and instead of adjusting, he just looked to have that, if I hold the ball a little bit longer, things are going to get better, look on his face. Always a good look. Jay Cutler has that look going on. Winners, I got to say Eddie Royal, strong game for number 19. Losers, me. I went with too much variety with the snacks. I mean, really, too many foods paying for today. You can't go smoked sausage, cheese, and guacamole. It is... No, it's early for me, too. It's early. I'll get it together by next week. I guess the Bears make you realize that there are a lot of young no-namers on this squad and no real breakout stars. Seriously, who gets the local Chevy commercial from this team? Who's going to stand between two lawyers and say, if you're ever injured in a car accident, right? According to the papers, a leader in the locker room is Alshon Jeffrey, who did have 100-plus yards in the first half but was shut out in the second. If it's not him, then who? Kevin White? He ran the wrong route, causing an interception, got a false start penalty, and missed a catch, albeit a tough one, that would have kept a drive going and made up for Cutler getting pummeled. So much to talk about. I'm channeling my inner OB. Come on! What's the matter with you? Best radio in radio, by the way. We'll save it for Doug Plank later in the show. The Cubs, let's talk about the winners. They beat up on Houston this weekend. Now the magic number down to 5. And they start a three-game set with the Cardinals tonight. A sweep, and they could clinch it in the Lou. Wait, is it called? Did they say the Lou? They're going to clinch it in the Louis. It doesn't matter. They're going to clinch it in St. Louis. The best part is they'll spray a bunch of Budweiser all over the visiting locker room, which would be nice. You know, and all the executives will walk in and go, ugh, that's what our beer smells like? Ugh, yeah, sucks. Sox once again looked promising, then lost two straight at home. Lose to KC. Sale pitched eight innings, breaking some crazy record for most consecutive starts pitching. Oh, why am I torturing you Sox fans? We're not breaking anything. Ah! It's already rebuilding time. Let me give you some more positive news. Me, personally, my fantasy baseball, made it to the second round of the playoffs. So maybe we'll spend a couple hours later in the week talking about that. If you're interested. No? No one is? Oh, well, we'll see. Pete is. In college football, the Northwestern Wildcats lost at home to the Illinois State Redbirds on a late field goal. That's a loss to Illinois State and Western Michigan at home. What the what? Not the ideal start for a team that was thought to be a top 25 squad. Also, Lovie Smith and the Illini blown out by North Carolina at home. So are there any other options for Chicago's Big Ten team? I mean, a lot of people living here went to Michigan. Harbaugh played for the Bears. Can Michigan just be the Big Ten team for Chicago? Anybody? And finally tonight, this past August was the hottest month on record. Yep, of all time. The planet is heating up. What can be done to stop it? I say we could either get the world's biggest box fan or we can get Kanye West to shut his mouth. What can I say? I'm an environmentalist. Hilarious. Seriously, we're dying. That's the carryout for September 12th, 2016. It's going to get colder this week, so we're bringing back soup. Actually, it's the same soup from the spring. We just turned the burner back on. Coming up, it's Touche. We'll talk about Hillary Clinton's health, also about what Donald Trump thinks of and Donald Trump fans think of deplorable. Much more to talk about, including the passing, untimely passing of Paul Green. We'll have that conversation coming up after 7:30 here on the Download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right, coming up, Touche here on the Download. Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
Oh, man, I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm good. I'm good. Tough game. I want to hear all about Northwestern. What was that like? I mean, it's such a low-scoring game, too.
I can give it to you in about 3 seconds, because that's all it took for Illinois State to actually win the ugliest football game that I've ever
seen. I mean, was there a point when you were watching where you're like, at the beginning, you're like, oh, this is slow. Is there a point where you're like, I'm starting to sweat this out?
It was bad. It was bad.
Man.
Yeah, my dad's had season tickets. He was a 71 grad. We've had season tickets for about 30 years now. And, I mean, there were lean years when Dennis Green was here, no doubt. Mm-hmm. But this is not a good start to a season that initially held some promise.
Yeah.
It's not good at all.
Well, I'll ask you more questions throughout the night.
Sure.
I'm curious about your experience.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what you said.
Well, that's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
You go right, you go right, you go left, you go right, you go right, you go right, you go left.
It's not all right.
All right.
She's sick.
You go right.
She's failing.
It's
got weakness in the extremities.
Oh, here we go. It's the Touche.
Starting
it's Monday
hard
night
here.
It's time for our weekly look at national politics. A lot going on this weekend. Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling in studio to argue about Hillary's health, the deplorables, and some Putin love as well.
Good to see you guys.
How are you guys? Good to see you, man.
Putin. All right. So before we get to that, let's start and honor our dear friend Professor Paul Green. Paul Green. Just untimely, I mean, just an aorta. They said it was an aorta aneurysm. He passed this weekend. Terrible loss for the WGN radio family here, but also for the political family here and the community here in Chicago. Because he was a great political pundit, a guy who really spoke. I've had him on countless. I was thinking about it yesterday, reflecting on this. I mean, probably 50 to 100 times. We just did election night together, the primary together. It's a big loss for the political community here in Chicago.
Yeah, it's huge. Paul was
the chairman of the City Club and moderated. For those who've been fortunate enough to attend when Paul moderates at City Club, he is both obnoxious while being hysterically funny and with an encyclopedic knowledge. And he's been an institution in this city for literally decades. I personally have known him for almost 30 years. And I have to tell you, I read this tweet yesterday morning while I was out in on a ride, and I was just devastated. It's such a shock because Paul is as integral to the Chicago political community as Tim Russert was to the national political community, and both died in years right before presidential elections that are historic, amazing presidential elections. I just have such warm feelings for Paul, and I know, Chris, you worked very closely with Paul.
Yeah, Paul and I were on the board of the City Club together for more than 25 years, and I certainly supported his becoming chairman of the City Club, and loved him dearly, and knew Paul in a variety of ways, not just through the City Club, but before that, when I worked for the South Suburban Congressman George O'Brien. Paul was an elected official down in Will County. He was a township supervisor down there. And was really pouring his all into that activity. I think that was the only time he ever ran for office. But, you know, he was from the streets of Chicago. The kid grew up. His father owned a car dealership about maybe 40th and Cottage Grove. And so he knew politics from the street level and the precinct level on up. And I think that is one of the bases for the resonance to which David refers, because not only was he completely fluent in and conversant in precinct level knocking on door politics, but he also had the whole veneer and the whole substance of the University of Chicago PhD. So he understood the library research and running regressions and
But he knew what made politics tick, especially in this town.
He didn't accept
the other.
Right. And he didn't accept the kind of superficial analysis that so often passes for political punditry. I've done
which we'll engage in momentarily.
Exactly. That'll be after the break. He was
coming up.
I didn't always agree with Paul. I mean, he was on my side of the aisle, but I didn't always agree with Paul. But I always found his insights interesting, and it's why he was such a great pundit, because he had such amazing depth of knowledge, and he loved this stuff.
Right.
You know, we often talk about political junkies, which all of us sitting behind these microphones are.
We're deplorable for it.
We are our own basket of deplorables. He was just, he had an amazing hunger for this stuff. And he loved it. So he would go deep in the numbers, as Chris said, and he would go precinct by precinct and do these interesting analyses. And, we will as a community be poorer.
Well, no election for, I think maybe all of us, was complete until about 3 weeks later, when we would get his analysis. He would send out the analysis that he had performed by hand on the numbers, eyeballing the races that he thought were important and the precincts and the trends and everything. And he came up every time I would read those and you'd see some insight, you'd get some view of things that you had not yourself come up with. And, this will be a much less agreeable election, win, lose, or draw, because we will not be getting that,
Professor Paul Green, who died this weekend unexpectedly, he will be missed. The WGN radio family has been tributing him all day, and we continue to keep his family in our prayers, thoughts here at WGN and in the city of Chicago. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling, Hillary's health, deplorables, Putin love.
Putin love.
Touche. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what you said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche. You go
right, you go Touché. Right. Touche. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy in studio. Let's get to it. Tonight, obviously, a big weekend for Hillary's health. What was a conspiracy theory turned into reality as video was released of her leaving a 9/11 remembrance, getting into the van, having to be helped. It did not look good from any vantage point, any angle. that Hillary Clinton was having a hard time walking under her own power. It comes out she has pneumonia. She shouldn't have been there in the first place. But, you know, there's a lot of criticism to the way that there's this was all held in privacy. Where are we, Dave Lundy, with Healthgate for HRC?
Okay, well, first of all, let's be clear about something. You just said that the conspiracy theory turned into reality. No, it didn't. The conspiracy theory is that Hillary has Parkinson's. Zero evidence. Hillary has Parkinson's. Chris here has posted on my Facebook page lots of times that Hillary has Parkinson's.
I have not
No, I forgot. Initially, you didn't put a question mark after it. And when I called you on it, you edited your comment to add a question mark.
It's just absolutely false.
But let me
tell all these nice people sitting out here, these are falsehoods.
No. So let me just read
something like Parkinson's with a question mark or just Parkinson's.
Or every Parkinsonian meme on the alt-right.
The point here is that Hillary
cannot tell the truth. Can I read her comments? Can I read her comments? So Hillary decided to tell the truth. So Hillary did an interview with Anderson Cooper tonight.
Wake up the news department.
Hillary did an interview. Listen to Rob. Oh, no, he's not there.
Pull some tape, Ralph.
So Hillary did an interview tonight on Anderson Cooper, and she said, quote, "I just didn't think it was going to be that big a deal. It's just the kind of thing that if it happens to you and you're a busy, active person, you keep moving forward. I was supposed to rest 5 days. That's what they told me on Friday, and I didn't follow the very wise advice." So this is what Hillary said tonight. And you could look at this two different ways. On the one hand, you say, okay, you're right. You should have followed your doctor's advice. What were you thinking? And on the other hand, as a campaign operative, and I happen to think the Clinton campaign is very well run, but occasionally and usually around these kinds of things,
they trip up. Yeah.
They make a big mistake, and they made a huge one.
It's around privacy. It's always around whether or not what should be divulged to the public.
Right. So
deception. Methods of deception.
So yesterday,
modalities of deceiving the public.
Instead of sending out a statement at 11 o'clock in the morning, which they should have done, that said, on Friday, Hillary Clinton was diagnosed with Parkinson's. She tried to power through it and had five events on Friday. Did I just say Parkinson's?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Okay. Chris, you've even got me believing the big lie.
Cancel that tape.
Anyway, strike that. So on Friday, she should have said, I was diagnosed with Hillary was diagnosed with pneumonia. She tried to power through it. And as a senator from New York, she was committed to the 9/11 families and wanted to be there for the event.
Let me ask Chris this.
That's what she should have done. I hear that.
I hear everything that's happened and I go, you know what? I buy it. Do you buy it?
No. Heck no.
And your evidence?
I mean, look, Hillary, first of all, it goes back to the cattle futures. I mean, you just can't believe a word that comes out of her mouth. Excuse me.
The cattle did not have Parkinson's.
Right.
And so she gets to the, she destroys 30,000 emails. You know.
Oh, my God.
Right. I'm serious. And now about her health. And let me stipulate by saying, as the Republican in this touche panel, we don't know anything about Trump's health either, and we ought to. And Hillary and Trump both ought to get their health records, put them in a room.
Is that a normal thing?
It is what McCain did, and it should become normal for every. Get your health records, put them in a room, and either put in independent doctors like the dean of the UCLA Medical School and the Yale Medical, whatever, or invite pool reporters to go in. And scour this stuff. The reason that people are talking about, they're coming up with their own theories about Hillary's well-being, which I hope that she recovers from pneumonia or fatigue or dehydration or whatever she is afflicted by. But the only reason people are talking about it is because, as David said, the campaign cannot get its head on straight about saying. So on Friday, before the basket of deplorables comment, apparently she was diagnosed. They said nothing then. Okay, they said nothing Saturday. She goes to this thing, and they come out with something that is just part of the truth and not the whole truth. And then 4 hours later, by the way, they ditched the NBC pool reporter who was supposed to be with them. They ditched the New York Police Department escort that was supposed to escort her so that she doesn't get into some kind of accident or whatever, or, you know, God forbid, an assassination. Then they overruled the Secret Service because the Secret Service has a protocol that when this happens to a candidate, whether Republican, Democrat, male, female, they're supposed to go to the ER overruled the Secret Service.
Let's make a transition to the next topic here as we run a little short on time tonight. Okay, Can the baskets of deplorables?
Yeah,
that's after the pneumonia diagnosis. Maybe she wasn't thinking clearly. Maybe the drugs.
No, I'm kidding.
What's the take on that? Because that's not a good start for her.
There are those who believe, who genuinely believe, that the basket of deplorables comment was fine, that the only problem with it was that she said it was half of his supporters. And by the way, if you look at polling from March, you will find that half of his supporters believe that blacks are inferior, that blacks are less intelligent, that blacks are prone to crime.
No, it is true.
It was Reuters Ipsos. It's not a misrepresentation.
It's a misrepresentation.
The Trump support is 46%. It was the March poll numbers.
Not that blacks are inferior. Come on. That is not one of the findings. Now, come on.
They're less. Oh, you're right, Chris. They just are less intelligent, more violent, and more criminal. That's what Trump supporters believe.
It's okay.
20%.
I
believe they should
hold on.
This is a window into how the elites despise regular people.
No, it's not.
And it's a window. It is indeed. Because not only does she say that they're deplorables, the other half she described as, you know, down and outers, dead enders, losers, basically people who are relying on some force out beyond themselves to take over. And this is why. She said 100% of the people supporting Trump are somehow debilitated. And then she got to the point, and this was about the deplorables. She said these people are not Americans.
No, she didn't.
She said they're not America. That is what she said, not America. And she said they're irredeemable. Irredeemable. I mean, this is outrageous. And
I'm sorry
Republican
she didn't say something wise like that his supporters were rapists and I'm sure some of them are good people. That would have been so much superior.
Well, let me ask
your problem, Chris, is that your candidate is a racist and a bigot and has encouraged. And David Duke has repeatedly come out and said Donald Trump represents the values of our white nationalist movement.
Well,
he
David
hired
Duke's
the
idiot.
Media head of the alt-right movement to run his campaign.
How much of this is just bad politics in the way that you're trying to demonize the other side? You're trying to alt-right is Trump. You're trying to say that even say like the liberal left is Clinton. Like
right.
How much of this is just playing to the stereotypes that our country is
now? An unwritten rule is that you don't attack the supporters of your opponent.
I agree.
Okay. And I think that, and maybe Hillary, God forbid or whatever, I hope she gets better, but maybe she was already depressed or dehydrated or suffering from pneumonia or whatever. But this is beyond, this rhetoric, if you listen to NPR this morning and you listen to Cokie Roberts analyzing this on NPR, you're going to hear her say that this rhetoric is far beyond the normal for
it's surprising.
Hillary.
It's surprising
this
for a Democrat to go.
It was,
let me ask you also, but though, as we get short on time here, I want to go to Putin. There, I mean, the other thing that's happening here is just this continuing relationship that seems to be bubbling up in this election between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin.
Yeah,
I don't understand.
Looks like Putin love.
Okay.
Look, what frustrates me most about the baskets of deplorable comments from a political standpoint is that Donald Trump was being destroyed because of the comments he made in the Commander-in-Chief Forum about Putin. He was being, all these Republicans were being asked about their views on Putin and Trump's views on Putin, and he was self-destructing, and the basket of deplorables comment interrupted that.
Yeah.
That's,
yeah, right.
From a political perspective,
thank you, Hillary.
That was a big political mistake.
Hillary,
that said, Donald Trump has to answer for not just Putin, but also the fact that he owes $1.5 billion to the Bank of China on his buildings.
Just all the business
and he hasn't
dealings,
disclosed
right.
anything and because his tax returns he won't let us see. And now
he
we find out his foundation
his
is a
returns.
Sham.
He ought to disclose his tax return. And Hillary ought to disclose the speeches to the big banks that she doesn't want
totally
to see.
Totally not analogous.
Okay. I'm just saying disclosure is good for the goose and the gander. And I want to say this. Hillary is the candidate of Putin in this race. And the reason that is Hillary is the candidate of Putin in this race. There is no question about it. She is the one who failed at the reset and gave him the access to all of the uranium. So, I mean, the one who he knows how to play, the one he knows how to get from what he wants is Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Yes, and that is, of course, why the Russians have hacked the DNC, released all this DNC stuff, and are using their agent, Julian Assange, to attack her on a constant basis because they want Donald Trump, because they want Hillary Clinton. No, they want Donald Trump, who has said on the air, he said, well, if Putin says nice things about me, I'm going to say nice things about Putin.
You know, I got to tell you something.
Last word. Come on. You know this stuff. You know how wrong that is.
I know that Hillary failed at the reset, and I know that the relations between Obama and Putin and the United States and Russia are not nearly what they should be, and that is because Obama has systematically withdrawn and reduced and diminished American influence in the Middle East and in Eastern Europe.
All right, Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, another episode of Touche. We'll be back next Monday, and then the Monday after the debates. We got some big Mondays coming up.
Big Monday debate.
Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling, stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up at 9, Doug Plank, the great Chicago Bears safety, will be in studio, or he'll be on the phone, right? He's on the phone tonight? Yeah. The reason Doug is always on the phone is because he's an NFL analyst, and so he gets assigned to different games around the country, and he's checking in, though, with us here on WGN Radio every Monday night to break down the breakdown of yesterday's loss to the Houston Texans. Man, that was bad. It was bad because it just felt like, I don't know, like you got very confident in the first half and you were excited and you're like, this could be a different Bears team. And then it ended by going, this is the same Bears team. Like that really was it. So we'll talk and we'll take your calls and texts too, 312-981-7200. If you want to ask Doug Plank a question, if you don't understand something happened yesterday, something been really getting at you, this is the time to unload. That's what we should call this segment, Unload with Doug Plank, 312-981-7200. That's coming up at 9 o'clock. And tonight, 10 o'clock, Los Shut Up, the band, is reuniting Chris Churchill and Tony Mendoza. They will be in studio as part of our Studio 435 live performance series every Monday night. My guest tonight at the big table is your Chicago small business owner in Chicago's Hyde Park neighborhood. But to say that the Silver Room is a small business is a huge understatement. Yes, they sell jewelry, they're a storefront, but they also create community. Shows, festivals, block parties, art fairs, you name it. The Silver Room got its start in Wicker Park, spent 17 years there. But as the rents went up, it became much harder for the storefront to stay. So the Silver Room and its block party moved to Hyde Park. This year's Silver Room block party was the biggest yet, 15,000 people, proving that community isn't always defined by boundaries, but it's tied together by spirit. Eric Williams is the man behind Silver Room. He's had so much success with this little storefront that people want to hear about his story nationwide. He's heading to Harvard University in October to talk about using retail to affect change, community, all that stuff. The man behind the Silver Room, Eric Williams, my guest tonight on The Download. Good to see you.
Hello, sir. Thank you.
First time we met, and I was just thinking about this today when I was reading this stuff, we were on a weird HGTV show. Remember that? Like, we were like, I forgot the name of it, but it was like, we live in Chicago. And they grabbed a couple Chicagoans.
Wow, yeah.
Remember that?
I forgot.
I forgot about it too. I was like, because I've known you with Silver Room, I've known you for years. And then I was like, wait, but the first time we met, we were like,
wow.
It was like, let the locals show you around Chicago. And we were right. The guys that like they picked to show Chicago.
Yeah, I forgot all about that. Yeah.
How you doing?
Great. Thank
so,
you.
So amazing, amazing success with this year's block party, Silver Room block party. Talk about the block party's origins, where it came from, and why you think it had so much success this year.
The long story short is I started the block party 14 years ago, kind of as an answer to the other street festivals that were going on that I didn't really like too much. You know, from the food, the music, I kind of wanted to curate something that spoke to me and my friends. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was a street vendor is how I started off. So I would go and pay money to, you know, to have a booth at these other street festivals. I'm like, ah, you know, I spent $1,000 this weekend at the street festival that I didn't really like. Let me take that money and do my own little thing. So the idea was always just very small. Our stage was made out of cinder blocks and some wood. My friends were DJing. I had it in an alley next to where I lived. We had extension cords coming out of my house. I mean, this was never meant to be anything big. You know, my friends DJ, my friends perform. We just came out and just did it. And it was all free. And it was great. And they, let's do it again. We did it the next year. And they told their friends and so on and so on and so on, you know, and then it grew from this little small intimate, you know, 100 person thing to 15,000 people. But to me, the essence of it has been the same. It's been community. It's been a very non-commercial kind of thing. It's been a chance to let my friends, who most of them are artists, to come out and express themselves mm-hmm. in a very pure way. A lot of times when you're doing things in a commercial, you know, venue, you have to kind of play certain kind of music or do certain things here and there. This is the opposite of that. It's like, you know what? Come out. You get a chance to play what you want to play today. And it's really good music. It's really good dance. And it's a way to engage everybody. We have performers that are 8 years old to 80 years old. It's all kind of music. It's just a really, to me, it's a culmination of the year, a celebration of art.
Well, it's amazing, too, because it really has been became a staple of the Wicker Park community. Mm-hmm. I mean, like you said, you were 17 years in Wicker Park, and it really almost embodied what that neighborhood stood for. I mean, it went through a lot of changes, and in those changes, it also sort of became unaffordable for you personally to have the Silver Room there. But talk about, you know, what makes the Silver Room Block Party such a staple? What makes it so different than the ones that you were, setting up vendors for that you didn't like?
I think number one is the mentality of what we go into it, you know, to be. It's not about making money. It's not about selling beer. It's about really bringing some good people together and celebrating art and culture. And I think that to me is when you go into that with the mentality, you can kind of create some really good, you know, some good magic.
Mm-hmm.
It's all ages. It's all, it's diverse. It's for everybody. So there really isn't any any scheme in any way, you know.
Well, that's a big part. I mean,
you know, it's not gimmicky. It's not about we're going to have this over here. And it's like, you know, we're going to come together and I want to keep it. The idea of a block party to me, when we think about like the best times of our life, usually it's like ideas of when you were like a little kid. You know, an idea of a block party is like, you know, you got the old lady in the corner telling you what to do and the young kids are playing around. Just very pure and natural. And I think that's the essence. You feel like a little kid because it is a block party. And I think people, they miss that. Everything is now so contrived and about money and about, you know, selling these, you know, silly little gimmicky kind of things. And ours is just like, let's just come out and have fun.
No, that's so true. I mean, there's so many street festivals in Chicago as we wrap up the season here. I mean, we've seen every, you know, it seems like every block has one now. But a lot of that is about just, it's a moneymaker.
Right. And, you know, I get it. That's fine. And I wish mine did make money. It doesn't, you know, but I think it's important that we do these things to kind of show that humanity still wants something that's very pure. So
Eric Williams is the owner of the Silver Room in Hyde Park. He's also going to have an art fair that's going to be in Hyde Park. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Coming up November, he's going to be at Harvard in October talking about the success of Silver Room and how you create community around a storefront, a commercial space. We'll talk with Eric some more here on the download. We'll take a quick break. Stay with us. It's a big table here on the download. I'm Justin Kaufman. In the studio with me, Eric Williams. Eric Williams is the man behind the Silver Room. Silver Room is, I mean, I want to call it a jewelry store. It's much more than a jewelry store. But it was, it was at the epicenter of Milwaukee Avenue and Wicker Park for years, for 17 years. It was a well-documented story that you chose to leave the neighborhood, Wicker Park, to move to Hyde Park, mostly because Wicker Park, the rents went through the roof. I mean, that was a no-brainer for you to do that. But what brought you to Wicker Park in the first place?
I lived in Wicker Park for 7 years before I opened the store.
So what was that, early 90s?
91, 90, somewhere around there. Well, the short story is that I was going to UIC and I wanted to be in a neighborhood. I couldn't rent by UIC. They wouldn't let me live there for a bunch of reasons. But so I found Wicker Park because it was very cheap to live there. You know, you could catch the blue line. It was a up-and-coming neighborhood. Mm-hmm. It was diverse. I had some artist friends there, some DJ friends were throwing parties in loft spaces. And, you know, it was just kind of a cool, hip place. It was, you know, just all kind of people. I enjoyed it. So I settled there.
At what point did you say, okay, I want to be a bigger part of Wicker Park. I don't want to just be someone who lives here. I have an idea for a store. I want to open it.
Well, my story was I was a street peddler while I was in college. So I used to go down to Maxwell Street and I'd buy stuff from down on Maxwell Street and go sell it after school. You know, that's how I made my money throughout college. And after
something to do with you them not letting you live by UIC? You're starting to paint a bigger picture here.
Yeah, man, I was a hustler. You know, so I was selling T-shirts and sunglasses and you know, I was selling at the Cubs games. This is, again, this is 89 through 94. I was
so you would go to Maxwell Street, buy some stuff, and then go to different places where people would congregate and sell
street
it
peddler. Yeah. I used to sell right here. I used to hide behind Michigan Avenue, right behind that thing, because the police couldn't see me. So I would sell T-shirts right there. So, yeah, it's funny. Yeah, I used to sell stuff, you know, street peddler. And I started traveling around the country selling stuff, and then I settled, you know. After 7 years, I was like, okay, I got to take this inside. And I had a friend that had a store. I was selling stuff from his store. And long story short, I found a storefront, you know.
Well, I'm fascinated by the street peddler stuff. I didn't know that about you.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I think about the life of people who are selling up and down Michigan Avenue here, mm-hmm. and there's a lot. I mean, you see it every day. We're coming in the Tribune.
Chicago Avenue is where I started, right there.
Right there. Yeah. So you're selling whatever you can sell, right? Mm-hmm. You sell. What was your game? I mean, how did you get? How did you unload your stuff? Were you charming? What was your thing?
I don't know how charming I was. You know, I had to pay my tuition, so I worked at Taco Bell. Again, this is 89. Minimum wage was $3.35 an hour.
Wow.
For those of you who remember minimum wage, I was making $3.35 an hour. And my friend was selling T-shirts and stuffed animals and balloons in front of the McDonald's. And he was like, you know, if you sell one T-shirt, you can make more than $3. You know, do you think you can sell one T-shirt per hour with all these people walking past? I'm like, yeah, I think I can do that. And that was always my goal, you know, and I would sell two shirts per hour, three shirts per hour. I was like, Taco Bell.
But doing that, I mean, how was it in your blood? I mean, you sales in your blood?
No,
I mean,
not at all.
Was it hard for you to do that?
I was kind of shy, actually. And then, you know, my friend kind of, you know, gave me a little bit of inspiration and just kept saying, just, you know, just go out there and try. Just, you know, don't be afraid. The people, they actually enjoy this, you know, and once I had started selling, it's like, you know, just kind of kept going. And people did enjoy me. And they would come back and see me the next day. And even if they didn't buy anything, they would say hi. And they saw me out there every single day and start to make more sales and learn little tricks of the trade. And, you know, that's how I started. But it was a lot of fun.
How much of that, I mean, that experience of you know, as you set this up, you said you had to take it inside after 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
How much of that experience led you to saying, I want a brick and mortar. I want to find a space. I want to do something that is like that. That I almost wet my tongue with this stuff. I wet my lips with this stuff. I'm interested.
Well, I mean, honestly, street peddling was probably the best experience of my life. I mean, I have a finance degree. I've done some things, but Chicago Avenue and Rush Street. I mean, you got people catching the red line going to the west side. You got, you know, the Gold Coast folks. You got tourists. You got suburbanites. You got a little bit of everything. A lot of homeless people. So it, to me, was where I learned that it's so many different kinds of people, but everybody's kind of the same. I learned how to treat everybody the same. And I wanted people to treat me the same, you know. And I think that was like my biggest education was street peddling. And, you know, and it's the same approach now when I'm inside. It's like everyone's the same, you know, and you don't know how much money somebody has by based on how they look, or if they spend $5 or, you know, $500, they still get the same kind of treatment. So
does that experience from being in Chicago and Rush, it helps you as a businessman?
100%. Yeah. Yeah.
And so talk about the beginning. What did you want Silver Room to be? When you opened Silver Room, what were you thinking? What kind of store was it going to be?
I didn't have a job, so I was I was a street peddler. I didn't want to do that forever. It was starting to get cold. One winter, I'm like, okay, I can't do this forever. And I knew how to go and buy stuff, and I knew how to sell stuff. I had this space that was very inexpensive at the time. I had some turntables. I was a DJ also, which I still dabble in a little bit here and there. I just want to have a space I could just kind of call my own, you know, and I could play my own music in this space.
Sure, all that stuff's great. I mean, everybody wants that, but right. How are you going to pay the rent?
Right. So I just figured, hey, I got this stuff. It's sold outside on the street. If people were buying stuff for me on the street, they'll buy stuff for me inside. And, you know, and then the store kind of morphed into what it is now just over the years. So it was first, I was selling things and you meet somebody. Hey, I make jewelry too. Can you sell my stuff? And I would do that. And my cousin makes hats, you know, and then that would happen. And hey, you have blank walls. I'm a painter. Can I put my painting on your wall? So like, wow. Okay. Now I have an art gallery, you know? So I think it kind of morphed over the years of me just realizing that this retail space can be much more.
Yeah,
and right. It was not really me. It was everybody else who kind of I allowed them to use a space as their own space.
Does that come from somewhere? I mean, does that come from the idea of selling stuff on the street where you have to collaborate? The gentleman you were talking about who was giving you the tricks of the trade, you know, mm-hmm. saying, can you sell T-shirts? You can do it. I mean, was that the spirit that you approached Silver Room with. The idea someone comes in and said, hey, I'd like to sell my drink. You're like, all right.
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's like, you know, you see people having a hard time and you, I don't see a person on the street and just think about that moment. I think about what got them to that moment. And a lot of times it's they didn't have any help. They didn't have any assistance. They didn't have any guidance, you know. So I just saw the spaces. If I can help somebody, why wouldn't I? You know, it's not hurting me, you know. So if I can help somebody sell jewelry and it's going to benefit me, then why not, you know. Then I started realizing that this is more than just retail. This is actually a social, you know, movement. It's a gathering space. It's a classroom. It's a, you know, it's an art gallery. It's all these things. And we can do these things in this space. Why not? And I can have fun doing it and make a little money. Yeah, it's you
At
know.
What point did you, I mean, doing that and being able to have different artists and people from the community come in and, you know, put art on the walls and sell jewelry. At what point did you recognize that this store, Silver Room, was much, much more than just a brick and mortar store? And when did you realize that it was really the focal point of what became Wicker Park?
Probably one block party. You know, I've probably been doing them for 5, 6, 7 years, you know, and again, it was just like, oh, block party, blah, blah. I remember one year I was doing it and I was standing on the stage at the end of the night and Ron Trent's my, you know, it's my partner for many years, you know,
great musician.
And he always closes out the night. And I was standing on the stage and I was like, it's a lot of people here. I was like, wow. And I think Hebrew Brantley was doing the mural and it was just this vibe of like, wow, this is, we know some talented people.
Right.
You know, and we kind of did this. This is kind of cool, you know. And for me, what's most important is always seeing kids enjoy themselves. And I saw kids dancing and just people just smiling and art was happening and music and dance. I'm like, this is cool.
Eric Williams, my guest in studio, is the owner of Silver Room in Hyde Park now. We're going to talk about that transition coming up here after the news. Also, just the concept of when retail becomes much more. That's what we're talking about tonight with A True Chicago and Eric Williams, the Silver Room. And there's an art fair coming up in November. He's going to be at Harvard in October talking about using retail to affect change. Eric Williams, my guest at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, Eric Williams, the owner of Silver Room in Hyde Park.
Hello. How are
you? Hello. Talking to us about his great career selling here in Chicago. Just off air, we're talking about how special Michigan Avenue is to you from your days of selling t-shirts and tchotchkes here. Yeah. It's a whole different city. You're right. I mean, to do that pre-daily.
Yeah.
I mean, to be selling t-shirts on Michigan Avenue was a whole different thing. Once Mayor Daley came in, you don't see that anymore.
Yeah, people didn't care back in the day. You could have illegal parties and do whatever you wanted to do. Nobody really cared.
Nobody cared.
Park wherever. Nobody gave you a parking ticket, you know.
It's changed.
Yeah,
the city's changed. Well, the city's changed, but, you know, Silver Room got pretty big. I mean, we're talking about in the last decade or so, the block parties got bigger. The store got national notoriety for what you were doing, not just with selling merchandise or like you said, jewelry, t-shirts, whatever it is. It became what Harvard wants to talk to you about, this retail space that really it defied just brick and mortar. It became sort of a community meeting place. How did that come about?
It came about because I think for me, it's not just the merchandise. I mean, obviously people come in and buy stuff. I mean, I'm always very clear. It's a retail space. But I started realizing that everything kind of spoke the same language, from what people were buying to what music was playing in the store to what kind of art hung on the wall to the kind of conversations we had, you know, political stuff, whatever, you know. So I think it kind of made a certain kind of person feel like they were a part of it. And those people have certain interests.
Not unlike a record store. I mean, I think about that used
exactly.
to be like the...
It's a certain culture. Culture.
Right.
So, I mean, I think every business has a personality. Like every radio station has a certain personality. You think of WGN, you think of something. Something comes to mind. So I think for me, it was really just kind of over the years, what Silver Room, what it meant to certain people and the people that came here, came to the space, I felt like we all kind of spoke a certain language. So I knew politically we'd probably be in alignment in some ways. I know musically we'd be in alignment a certain way. So it made it kind of easier for me to kind of produce events because I knew everybody because they came to the store. So we had conversations. You know, they'd buy a ring, they check out. I learned they were teachers. They really cared about education. You know, I learned they were construction workers and they were just trying to provide for their families. So from meeting these people, I could kind of have a clear picture of who these people were and what they might need. Because sometimes they would say, hey, look, you know what? We just want a place to come meet and hang out and have a discussion and talk about life. So we started Grown Folk Stories, which was, you know, there's other
Carly
story nights.
Carly was on here. She's one of our first guests.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's plenty of story nights, but how do you tailor a story night to make it make sense for what you do? So I think everything that we've done has been tailored for our community.
And when you say your community, I mean, it straddles hip hop. I mean, the hip hop culture in the way, but it really, it just seems to be more of a diverse kind of place that people can go to that. It's very urban. I guess urban is the right way. I've always known it to be that.
Yeah, I guess it's the word. I mean, for me, I love house music. So a lot of it is based around music and house music specifically. Yeah. The people that come there are very caring people. They care about the community. They care about our city. They care about politics. I mean, most of them are probably pretty progressive liberal people, you know, and those things are all part of what the store is about, you know, I think that's kind of made the store be what it is. It's the people, you know. And then now the programming that we do is really not our programming. It's programmed from the community.
Yeah.
So we had a play there in the store a few weeks ago. It was these young girls. They were, you know, 8, 9, 10, 12 year old. It was great. We had a play in the store, you know, because for me, it's no limit. It's my space. Why not? You know, so we have discussions about things. We have relationship discussions. So it really is no boundaries to what the space could be.
Well, it was, like I said, right in the first half of this interview, we talked about how it was well documented that the rent was just too high in Wicker Park, and when your lease was up, you're going to have to go. Was it hard to leave Wicker Park? Was it scary in the way that you built such a movement and a space and a following to move to Hyde Park, to move out of that space? Was it difficult?
Yes and no. I mean, You do anything for a long time, you kind of used to certain things. I guess you had a girlfriend for a long time. You get used to her. You get used to everything, you know. But I realized I wasn't happy there the last few years. And I wasn't happy because the neighborhood had changed from what it used to be. From these people who wanted to have really good conversations.
To artists.
To even like the fellow owners of businesses who, if I ran out of credit card paper, I can go down there and say, hey, can I have a paper? Now it's corporate. So now you have to call the regional manager and they have to talk to their district manager just to get some credit card paper. Or before I could say, hey, Justin, man, hey, look, you know, how's business? Oh, it's great. Now those things are gone. So it was a combination of the customers were very different. The people who own the business in the neighborhood were very different. And I felt like an outsider in my own community. It just wasn't fun anymore. And then I also realized that the people who were coming to the store that were the most fun didn't live in the neighborhood anymore. They either couldn't afford it or they didn't want to be around there.
Yeah, it's interesting the way that gentrification plays when you're talking about space, when you're trying to create a community and a community's there, and then the actual, you know, built community around it changes.
Yeah, yeah, and that's what happened. So I looked up and it's like, I'm like, you know, I'm just like a foreigner in my own land. And people would say, how long have you been here? I'm like, I've been here for 4 years. I'm like, well, I've been here for 20 years, you know? And it wasn't fun. And so that part was easy for me to leave and say, hey, you know what? This is not something that I enjoy anymore. Financially, it didn't make sense anymore. So the University of Chicago, they had this big initiative, as you know, to build Hyde Park. And it asked me to come actually 2 years before. And I didn't do it. It just made the timing was right. My lease ended. I'm like, you know what? Do I try and commit to staying here in Wicker Park more years or try something new? So
was it hard for you as a guy who had seen the potential through the block parties, through the space, and all these people coming together? Did it all, as someone who that really is the lifeblood of what makes Silver Room work, were you at all like, geez, man, will they come? Will they come to Hyde Park?
Well, actually, it's a great question because that was my biggest fear, is that the people wouldn't come from the north side to the south side. Now, I had a lot of friends of mine who live all over the city, the south side. They were like, come out here. And my biggest fear was that the north siders wouldn't come to the south side. And guess what? They don't really come to the south side. And I think at first I was like, oh, my gosh. Nah, nah. But end of the day, there's a lot more people that come to the store from the south side. So right, right. The net is a net gain that, you know, we are very, you know, localized people in Chicago. We stay in our neighborhoods. If you live in Andersonville, you move there for a reason. So you pretty much stay in Andersonville. You stay in Albany Park or Logan Square or Inglewood or wherever, back in the yard, wherever you're at, you know. So people in Hyde Park, they're very pride. They have a lot of pride in Hyde Park, you know. So most of our customers are Hyde Park, South Shore, Bronzeville. You know, that's most of our customers.
And, you know, you've had success. I mean, obviously, we started this saying that this year's block party in Hyde Park, which you moved, what, about 2 years ago? A year and a half?
April of 2015.
Yeah. You know, you had the biggest block party
right.
you've ever had.
Probably twice as big.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's worked out. I mean, this is a success story when it comes to bringing that community to Hyde Park. How does it feel to be a part of a new community? Then, you know, like everything that's happening in Hyde Park, especially along 53rd Street and all the area there where they're really trying to rebuild. How does it feel to be sort of a cornerstone for that?
Oh, it feels great. I feel wanted. You know, and I think at the, you know, in Winkler Park, I didn't feel wanted. I felt like I was an outsider. You know, now it's like, I mean, I'm embraced. We're embraced to a point where it's like people walk past and say, thank you for being here. I mean, it's a really, really like, they're really happy that we're there. It's a sense of pride, you know, and being a black business is, you know, that's an added layer. So I feel like we serve a purpose in that neighborhood for a lot of reasons. And I'm happy. And I feel like it gave me a new energy to do more and to kind of push myself and to push the store. And
did you, I mean, being in Wicker Park, I mean, I mean, it's obviously a pride to be a black-owned business, right? Mm-hmm. For you, obviously, you're black. But yeah. But is it more proud to be in Hyde Park where that's more of an accepted thing, that where on Milwaukee Avenue, that really wasn't touted? That wasn't necessarily the reason to go to Silver Room. It was just kind of more the culture.
You know, I mean, yes, I didn't, you know, you don't think about it, you know, when you're buying watches and, you know, but when people tell you, you know, like, hey, this is really good that you're here. We need more imagery, positive imagery of black businesses. You know, you're like, oh, wow, I didn't think about that. I mean, but you hear it a lot.
Right.
You know, people will ask, is this a black-owned business? They ask that
in
Hyde Park. You know.
Where they weren't asking that in Milwaukee Avenue.
Not really. I mean, and if you're not black, you probably don't understand as much as being black. And I understand that, you know. And so that is a huge part of it. I'm not gonna lie to you. That's a big part of it now that, you know, we're in this neighborhood. I get Hyde Park is a very unique neighborhood, but just kind of having this space that symbolizes a lot of positivity is important. Outside of me, you know, having a business, I realize that my place is more important for a lot of people.
Eric Williams, my guest. He's the man behind the Silver Room, which is in Hyde Park. The art fair coming up in November. Also going to Harvard to speak on, which is just amazing to me, to go to Harvard and to talk about the success of Silver Room and how a retail space can affect community and change. Eric Williams, my guest. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. I just want to ask you about Chicago. You've lived here your whole life. You grew up in South Suburbs, Robbins, I want to talk to you about how it's changed in your eyes being here since, you know, peddling Bart Simpson t-shirts out here on Michigan Avenue. Eric Williams, my guest. Stay with us. Hello, Frankie Knuckles for Eric Williams. He's in studio. Eric Williams, the owner of the Silver Room in Hyde Park. All right. I'm interested, you know, because in a way you can sort of serve as the download sort of neighborhood historian. I mean, you've been around. I mean, you've been in a lot of different neighborhoods in Chicago and you've been here for decades. I mean, to talk about moving to Wicker Park in 1991, it's a different neighborhood.
Yeah.
To set up your shop in 1997. Yeah. It's a different neighborhood.
Yeah.
Talk about that. I mean, for you and through your eyes and the things that you've seen and the things that you've sold, how has Chicago changed?
I mean, good and bad, you know, it's like you want a community that is safe, that is X, Y, and Z, you know, you want vibrant businesses to be a part of the community, you know, but also you don't want to lose the essence of a neighborhood, you know, and, I haven't seen that happen. You know, you have neighborhoods that are like under financed, under resourced, nobody really cares. It's almost like a wasteland. They kind of left their own devices. And then at some point, somebody sees the opportunity, either to make money or to whatever the reason is, you know, and they come in and then somebody else comes in. And all of a sudden, that apartment that was $500 a month is now 800.
Well, Eric, I mean, you and the Silver Room follow in that same pattern, that, mm-hmm. that gentrification yeah. pattern of like, at first, you know, it'll be the people who were first a part of a neighborhood, and then the artists move in and the artists right. find space there. And then here comes the commerce, and the commerce has taken over a place like Wicker Park, which you were, I mean, the unofficial yeah. mayor of Wicker Park for yeah. a while there. But the point being that, like, I mean, you were there, you got to see a neighborhood change.
Right. I mean, honestly, I see both sides, you know, and I have a lot of friends who are, you know, very strongly on one side. But, you know, if you owned a building, you know, for 30 years and you've lived through a lot of the bad, depressing times, and you've suffered financially, et cetera, et cetera, and now you see, you know, changes starting to happen, and you have, you know, three or four kids, and, you know, your life is not that great, and someone offers you a bunch of money for your building, do you say no? I mean, that's real, you know? So I see that it's a very, it's not so cut and dry to me, you know? And even though I was, quote unquote, a victim of it, I have to realize that me being, you know, 27 at a place in time is very different from me now. And it's like, not about me trying to relive the past. It's about how can I make my life the best I can for myself at this moment, you know? So neighborhoods going to always change, you know, and people with money going to be able to change them. If you don't have any money and resources and don't own the land, you don't have a lot to say, you know? So how do you fit into that?
One of the things about Wicker Park that was always great was the diversity. A lot of different people that looked different congregating yeah. together, artists. The Silver Room was a great place for that. It changed over time. I mean, right. you go to Wicker Park now and it's pretty much primarily white.
Right.
You know, and your store, you know, we were talking off air just about the idea that sometimes people say, oh, you know what, don't go in there. That's the black store.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Like, is that hard to believe? I mean, that's hard. It's hard for me to believe about Wicker Park.
No, not really. I mean, I think the one thing about Wicker Park was that we were all kind of outsiders. You know, we were like misfits, you know. So we came from, you know, be it small towns or different parts of the city. You know, I said, you know, a lot of my friends were these white guys with, you know, big holes in their ears and tattoos, you know, and they were misfits, you know, and outsiders, and, you know, and we were too in a way. So we kind of had this common bond that everybody kind of got along. And now I think the second or third generation of people that come to the neighborhood, they don't understand the history of a neighborhood and don't have a respect for the neighborhood. You know, just the other day I was with my girl, and, you know, we're in Logan Square, and people walk past and don't even say hi. That's like, you know, that's just crazy to me. Like, we grew up where you just said, hey, hi, good morning. So you got somebody who's been in the neighborhood for 2 weeks and they don't speak to the person, you know, and that's really strange to me. So I think you have to yeah. kind of understand the, you know, the values of a neighborhood when you move into them and respect them. I think neighborhoods being gentrified is not necessarily just about, you know, money. It's about, you know, a respect for what was there before you. And I think that's what's lost, and a little bit of history, understanding who was there before you.
All right. So let me ask you this. You've been around Chicago for decades now and in several different capacities. Why do you stay here? What about Chicago keeps Eric Williams here?
I like Chicago, man. I've definitely probably had a love-hate relationship. Yeah, I travel, you know, I see things. I'm like, man, I really like South Africa. This is dope, you know. But, you know, Chicago, it's I'm like tearing up right now looking at Michigan Avenue, you know. It has a lot of heart. I mean, the music, and I think number one is the people. You know, we have a lot of really good people here, and I feel like I've added something positive to the city, and that's really important for me, you know. And from the music to the culture to mentoring, it's important that we have these positive examples in the city, and I like it. There's a lot of opportunity here. You know, it's a lot of opportunity here.
What can you tell us about the art fair that's coming up in November? You just got that cleared, right?
Yeah. So, University of Chicago, who are the landlords for most of us on 53rd Street, they want to do some really cool stuff in the community. And so they've kind of supported me since I've been out there, and I appreciate that. So they were talking about, you know, let's do something else in the fall. And I'm like, hey, you know, we should have like this art fair that is going to bring together some artists from around the city. We can kind of make it kind of cool and have some music playing and blah, 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 get the other business involved. So we're going to do an art fair called Connect November 11th, and it's going to be really, really good and come down to Hyde Park. You know, a lot of people on the north side don't come to Hyde Park. It's not that far away. Weird, yeah. You know, it's not that far. So we're going to give you a reason to come down.
Well, there you go. Eric Williams, the owner of Silver Room. You can check out the Art Fair Connect, which will be November 11th. It's also going to be at Harvard if you're listening in Boston. He will be at Harvard University talking about Silver Room and how retail can affect change. Eric, great to see you.
Thanks,
sir, for being my guest tonight.
Thank you, man. Appreciate it.
All right, let's get rid of that. All right. We need, you know what? I don't know. I have a lot of pride. Like I said, there's a part of me, I think I told Anna this today around 11 o'clock yesterday, that I went into this impassioned speech, to my son in the car as we were going to get snacks or coming back. And I'm like, this right here, there is nothing that makes me happier except for you. Than the hour before kickoff of opening day of Bears football, right? Nothing. And then you watch the game and you say, okay, here we go. This game starts and you're like, oh man, there's some competency here. They're catching the ball. They're moving around. They're finding Alshon. They were able to get a 2-minute two-minute drill going. They got a touchdown. I did the pump and I flexed my muscle at halftime. That's how you play football. And then it unraveled. Doug Plank joins me now. The Doug Plank, number 46, NFL analyst and a member of the Download crew who joins us every Monday. This is our first time to debrief when it comes to Bears regular season football. Doug Plank, good to talk to you, buddy. How are you?
Justin, always, always a pleasure. And I have to agree with you. I'll tell you, I think you nailed this assessment of what took place and how it was executed.
All right, so let's start with that. Overall, the Chicago Bears coming in were the underdog. I mean, obviously playing on the road against a playoff team that there are high hopes with a new free agent quarterback with Brock Osweiler. There were high hopes. They're even talking about Super Bowl. They even did the NFL Today, the Fox Sports show before, from Houston. I mean, everything was in Houston's favor. But the Bears, they came out strong, and right off the bat, it looked like we might have a shot.
I thought it was outstanding. I mean, I looking at the first half of the game, I thought they were flying around, really playing aggressive. They had some, mostly from an offensive standpoint, I think that, they were very efficient, as far as even on third downs, maybe not as quite as what they could have done. I thought their players made some plays. They were well covered, and their defense, they were in position to make plays, and they made plays. I mean, that's what was great about it. I mean, it just – the game's probably come down to maybe 5, possibly even 10 plays a game. But you know what? You look at that first half, whether it was an interception, a reception on offense, just the confidence. I'm a big believer in body language, and this was truly a game of two halves. To look at the body language on the sideline, even out on the field for the Chicago Bears, it was like two different football games.
Yeah. And obviously body language starts and stops with the quarterback, Jay Cutler. Jay Cutler started off pretty strong. He seemed to be in control of this new offense with the new offensive coordinator. He seemed to move the ball at will. They seemed to be finding, he was doing what he does best, which is be able to throw the ball up to Alshon Jeffrey. I mean, it felt like he was in command of this Bears team.
Yeah, and I think he was. There's one thing, though, that starts changing your attitude. And that is when you start getting hit and knocked on the ground. There were the Texans were able to sack the Bears 5 times. And obviously, Jay afterwards said that he felt, quite sore as a result of all those hits. That has an impact on a quarterback. I mean, maybe a quarterback that's 6'4", Cam Newton, maybe he could take that. But when you're a smaller quarterback, maybe not built as much. I'll tell you what, those things are cumulative and they add up. And you could just see, especially in that second half, gosh, they just started getting pressure. I was surprised how easy their defense came around on the edges. It's almost like they were letting that guy go and thinking he wouldn't get there in time. But too many times they just allowed that defensive end to come off the edge, and he just had a straight run and hit Jay, going at full speed. But you know, when you're that size and you can hit a guy smaller, I think you can do some damage.
Yeah. 312-981-7200 if you want to join the conversation, talk to Doug Plank, give us your thoughts on what happened yesterday with the Bears' loss in Houston. I have to say, as a football player, and you've gone through this, and give us some insight to this, you know, when a player like Jay Cutler continues to get hit like that and he gets a little bit sore, it seemed to me as the game went on that Jay Cutler seemed to hold the ball longer, that it felt like, you know, he wasn't necessarily taking shots when he needed or get rid of the ball when he needed to. Was that part of the fact that he'd been sort of thrown around the field and also sort of the game was too tight for him to make a mistake?
You know what happens to Justin? I think sometimes we all forget some of the basics of our position. Like, for example, at quarterback, you know, get rid of the ball early, especially if your offensive line isn't being real effective. And they were effective in the first half, but you could tell in the second half, they just, you know, the two evaluation measures of offense and defense. On offense, how long can you sustain a block? And on defense, how fast can you get off a block? And that was the two stories of this game. In the first half, if you watch, they were giving Jay plenty of time back in the pocket, find receivers downfield, move. I'm not saying he was scampering around back in the pocket, but he was moving left and right and finding throwing lanes. In the second half, it was like it all totally collapsed. It's almost like you were watching a regular season game in the first half and then a preseason game in the second half, because the breakdown in mental assignments as well as physical, I mean, I couldn't believe it. You know, the consistency and how well they played in the first half. And then that in the second half, I just think he started losing some of his confidence. He realized that he was getting a much more of a pass rush than he was in the first half. And, you know, some of that has to be put on the offensive line. I just don't think in the second half especially, you know, and what it boils down to, Justin, is on the third downs. Obviously, third downs basically dictate games. When you look at the third down situation in the second half, they only converted two first downs on eight attempts. I mean, that is not good.
No,
you know,
exactly.
You cannot win converting 25% of your third downs.
When you're an analyst and a player, but when you see a tale of two cities, like the tale of two tape, like you saw in this game where the first half and the second half are Jekyll and Hyde, is that a halftime adjustment? Did the Texans make an adjustment that the Bears didn't?
You know what? I have to totally I think I can't say enough about coaching and making adjustments. You know, I was fortunately able to coach for 13 years in the Arena League, college, and in the NFL. And, you know, that's what halftime is all about. It's about making the adjustments, being able to go in there and do the right thing and give your offense and defense a chance. And the same thing is true for college. You know, you can't go in there and just keep doing the same thing. I think what Houston did, they mixed up their coverages a little bit more in the secondary. And certainly what they did was they started sending an extra guy in the second half on pass rush. And it was very, very effective because I think that, you know, the coverage tightened up in the secondary. And they just weren't making the catches that they did in the first half.
Yeah, I want to take a quick break so we stay on time here, and I want to bring in some people too to talk. But you know, it did seem like there were a couple miscues by some rookies on the field or second year guys that really, really hurt the team. I want to talk to you about that, Doug, about the idea of rookies in big situations and what it means when they don't necessarily make the play. Doug Plank, my guest tonight here, as he is every Monday night, breaking down what happened on Sunday for the Bears. We'll take a quick break. 312-981-7200. We'll be right back at it. Stay with us. That's how we roll. It's a download here. We're breaking down the Chicago Bears loss to the Houston Texans with our man Doug Plank, a Chicago Bear great, good old number 46, NFL analyst, and our regular contributor here on the download Monday nights. As I mentioned right before we went to the break, Doug, the breakdowns that really hurt the Bears in two different occasions came from guys who had never been in a regular season game before. Cody Whitehair, who was playing center for, I don't know, the first time in his career. And Kevin White, who was playing wide receiver, who seemed to go the wrong way on a route. Talk about that. I mean, when the rookies get to the big stage, you know, how does a team make sure that doesn't happen?
Well, you know, usually you try to do that in preseason through exhibition. But, you know, like I said, you can tell that unless players are put in situations in practice or in exhibition season, they will usually not perform. And I tell people this all the time. You have to give credit to a lot of organizations that put players in first, second, third, fourth down situations, even special teams. You know, when it comes down to that last second and you're asking a player to do something, you can't just draw it up on a sideline and say, okay, I want you to do this, this, and this.
Yeah, right.
Well, if he hasn't done it in practice, it probably isn't going to happen. And I think that was pretty much a situation. You can't fumble the ball on fourth and inches. I mean, that just can't happen. You know, you have to practice that play over and over and over again, so it just becomes – you don't even think about it. You just go out there and react, and you do it. You know, things like that, like I said, especially that fourth down fumble, that was big. And, you know, you can blame it on a center because he's the one that obviously starts the action and snaps it back. And, you know, that was definitely a miscue by the Chicago Bears.
You know, other than that, the offensive line, especially in the first – half seemed to be put together, as you mentioned. The second half, they came undone. There's been a lot said about Josh Sitton coming to Chicago, Kyle Long playing his natural position, Cody Whitehair in the center. They were talking him up during the Fox broadcast. But as you mentioned, the two tackles on both sides, left and right, seemed to have their hands full and exposed what could be a problem for the Chicago Bears.
Yeah, you know, and it was, you know, just looking at the highlights, you know, you can watch the game, but then you can see somebody put a highlight reel together and then, you know, seeing, you know, plays happen back to back, like players coming off the edge. What these games are the game plan for the weeks that are coming up. So when other teams watch the Chicago Bears and the Texans, they're going to pick out all the plays where the weaknesses. And they were going to use all those same plays again. Those are going to be in their game plan for the next week until the Bears can prove that they can't, that they can block it, that they can get by on that play. So I promise you, they're going to be getting outside pass rush incredibly over the next couple weeks. And they're going to do everything they can to put pressure on those centers to try to induce another fumble.
Great.
I know that's not good news.
That's not what I like to hear.
But there was good news. How about that last drive the Bears had in the end of the first half where they drove 75 yards, I think in just three plays, culminating with that 20-yard, 19-yard touchdown by Royal. That was outstanding. And you think about that. They had 75 yards in one drive, and then you look at the second half, they only gained 71 total yards the whole second half. And they only had four first downs. I mean, that's how bad it was.
Yeah, and Alshon Jeffery played strong in the first half, was absent in the second.
Very strong.
But let's talk about Kevin White, the other sort of rookie, I guess, since he didn't play at all last year, second-year guy, first-round pick. He had obviously a missed route where he went. He didn't seem to run the route.
Yes.
Even the corner was covering the route in which they thought Kevin White was going to run. We saw a false start that he had. Which is never good for a wide receiver. We also saw him miss a ball that was tough. It was a low ball, but it was on a play that we needed where Jay Cutler got hammered and he couldn't come up with it. Not a strong first day for a guy that we're putting a lot of sort of our faith in for the offense of the Bears.
No, and you know, that's why being a football player is more than just running a fast 40 or having athletic skills and having speed and all that sort of thing. Where are you on third down and fourth down? The two most important plays, obviously, in football. And, you know, you got to make the catch. You have to come up with a play. You know, I get so angry as a coach when I would watch wide receivers. Why would a wide receiver ever, ever, ever be offsides or have, you know, false motion? I mean, you are all alone out there. No, it's around you. You're just watching. I mean, come on. That's a mental error. It has nothing to do with, they call it, you know, motion and stuff like that being physical, but no, it's a pure mental error. And I just think, you know, whatever happened, I don't know if it's the old drinking the Kool-Aid or whatever. They went into that halftime thinking, you know what, we're a pretty good football team. We're on the road. We're going to come up with the win. And they came out, and I just really think you cannot have that much difference between the first and second half without a change of mindset. And they certainly had a change of mindset when they went into that locker room.
All right, let's talk about some of the positives, at least on the defensive side of the ball. Two names that stuck out, or three guys that everyone paid attention to yesterday. The two linebackers, inside linebackers, Jarrell Freeman and Danny Trevathan, and the new outside linebacker rookie, Leonard Floyd, who got his first NFL sack. They showed that they had instinct. And I think that that's what it was. It seemed like every time that the Houston Texans wanted to make a play, one of those three guys was around the ball.
Yeah, you know what? Really, Floyd, I thought that, you know, he was more of an athlete than trying to run through people. I mean, he really showed me something. He had six tackles. You said he was involved in that sack. Mm-hmm. You know, I think everybody you talk to, they played extremely physical and tough. I was really impressed with how fast those guys got to the football. And when they got there, they made good tackles. You could tell they were well-coached, well-prepared for the game. And even the secondary. I mean, I think the secondary played well at times, you know, where there were other times where they just, you know, got matched up and there was relatively close coverage. You know, they just didn't make the play, which the plays, the same plays that they were making in the first half. So, you know, that's why I say, you know, when you're in a game like that, and all of a sudden your offense dropped down in production, only getting 71 yards, that means your defense is on the field a lot more of the time. And you just start mentally and physically getting worn down.
Yeah, I've always wondered about that.
That's what happened to Bear defense.
That, I mean, I remember that being an issue with Urlacher and Briggs, and you would have a dominant football game, but you'd have Kyle Orton or Rex Grossman just sort of three and out, Lovie Smith in the ball, where they would just punt and let the defense win. And it felt like with 3 minutes, 4 minutes to play, you always saw the Bears defense on their back, you know, getting pushed back as you know, sort of not being able to come up with a stop at the end of the game. That has to do a lot with mental fatigue, being on the field for too long.
There's no doubt. I mean, you know, plus physically, I mean, I know everyone's cut back now in preseason and the players are feeling, you know, a lot better in terms of physically and being, you know, rested and all that sort of thing. But the bottom line is, you're out on the field like that a long time. I'm not saying you get mad at the other side. Like if you're on defense, your offense, like I said, they only gained 71 yards in the second half. That meant the defense was out there a tremendous amount of time. You almost, you know, develop a bitterness. Like, hey, listen, guys, you need to help us out. You need to at least get first downs. If you don't score, at least give us a break. Let us rest over there on the sideline. Don't put us in a situation where we just got to, you know, keep going out there over and over and over again.
312-981-7200. I got a couple texts to read for you. But you know what? Let's save them. We'll do it on the second half of the news, if that's okay with you, Doug, if you can stick around.
Yes.
312-981-7200. We're talking about the Bears' loss to the Texans. And the question that I want to ask, and we'll do it after the break, is really just about, you know, looking at this team and what the team said after the game, just about we're this close, you know, we made mental mistakes that we know we're better than, we're this close to gelling. I think gelling was the word that John Fox used. Is that a reality when it comes to this Bears team? Could they be able to go and be able to turn it on and beat a team like Philadelphia next week on Monday Night Football? That's the question we'll continue to ponder with Doug Plank and you. 312-981-7200. Stay with us.
Some folks say there ain't no bears in Arkansas. Some folks never seen a bear at all. Some folks say the bears go around eating babies raw. And some folks got a bear across the hall.
The Lyle Lovett to get us into Bears postgame. I'll take it. The Chicago Bears lost yesterday to the Houston Texans. They're 0-1 in the NFC North, which saw all three teams win. The Lions in dramatic fashion. The Packers in dramatic fashion. The Vikings, I don't even know how the Titans, I don't even know what's going on there. Doug Plank joins us. Good old number 46, greatest safety of all time here in Chicago. And he, of course, covers NFL football. He's an analyst, and he's also here on The Download every Monday night. Doug, let's keep the conversation going. I have a couple questions that have come in for you. You know, when you have it, most of it's funny. When I ask people, hey, let's ask, here's a good one. I have a good text that came in from 773 that asks, what do you as an analyst, what do you focus on when you're watching a game? What's your style? What's your discipline like?
I immediately, number one, I love, like I said before, I love watching the sidelines because I think that if you don't even look at the field and you just look at all the activity on the sidelines, you can tell who's winning. And, you know, there's some teams that, you know, just have a natural energy and they're always, you know, if they're not in the game, they're always trying to fight to get back. I loved that game yesterday with the Chiefs. You know, those guys were still flying around when they were getting beat so bad in that game and they came back and ended up. I mean, you always have to believe in yourself. As an analyst, of course, you got to watch the football just like every other fan in America. But, you know, you bring in peripheral vision. I never really had good peripheral vision. You know, when I was in college playing at Ohio State, I came to Chicago Bears. I started playing a position I had never played before, free safety. I was always a cornerback
really?
Or a strong safety, never had played the position. But there was a kid injured, and they said, who's played free safety in here? You know what? I was a 12th-round draft pick. If I didn't start doing something fast, my butt was going to get cut, and I was going to be back in Ohio so fast I didn't know what was happening. So I stuck my hand up, hey, I've done it before. I've never played free safety. So I started learning the position. I would stand in the back by where the goalposts were when the offense was coming towards me, and I would try to concentrate on the split of the two receivers and be able to see them in my vision and then analyze everything in between. And wow. So, you know, it's the same thing now as an analyst. I do watch the ball, but my peripheral vision, I look at both receivers, the defensive backs, I see how deep they are at the snap of the ball. And the other thing is, the guys that don't lie, the offensive line, if they're going to pass, they're leaning back in their stance. If it's a running play, they're going to lean forward and put all the weight on their hands, which is usually on the ground. So you can usually tell run pass right away, and then you just look at body language, and you do it enough times over and over and over again, you start getting tendencies. I hate to be an analyst, though, and talk in that acronym like a lot of analysts do, acting like they're so smart. Some of those guys have no idea what they're talking about. They're throwing out blue zone, red zone, white zone, three technique. You know what? I'm sorry. If my wife can't understand what I'm saying, then I'm not going to say it.
There you go, Doug Blank. I love it. Okay, so one of the things we haven't talked about, which I think has been another strength, even though we didn't see it, we saw it in quick sputters, was the Bears' running game. It kind of got off to a slow start, but Jeremy Langford seemed to pick up some steam. The announcers on Fox, they seemed to really love it. Langford played at Michigan State. He all knows about the game. He gets stronger as he goes on. And as they were saying it, they seemed like they jinxed him because at that point, he just got shut down. But the point being that there were some, I would say, some positives with Jeremy Langford running the rock.
You know what? That was a big concern, don't you think, about the Chicago Bears, whether they were going to be able to maintain the same running game they had over the last couple of years. And I agree with what you're saying, Justin. I think, you know, they fought back. I thought he ran the ball very well. You know, that certainly didn't cost them the game. You know, it was the mental errors, you know, the bad snap on that fourth down in inches. That was big. I think just the general breakdown. It just looked to me like, you know, when I'm a coach, I want to turn a game film on. I want to see the same effort in the fourth quarter that I see in the first quarter. And I'll be honest with you, when I watched the Bears game, I didn't see that same effort.
Okay, so some other questions coming in. 312 wants to know, I felt like the broadcast spent a lot of time on J.J. Watt. As a former defensive player, do you feel like there's just too much hype around a guy like J.J. Watt? Is he overrated?
Yeah. Yes. Well, you know, I don't know if he's overrated or not. He does have a pretty cool name, you know, J.J. Watt. I mean, it kind of flows off your tongue real easy. He's done some tremendous things in the past, you know, in terms of taking over games and making fantastic defensive plays. But here's what happens. Before the game starts, all these announcers and the producer down in the truck, they have all these storylines that they go over before the game starts. It doesn't matter whether J.J. Watt didn't even come to the stadium. He was still going to get talked about.
Yeah, right.
Because you know what? They had made graphics, and they had gone over it the night before, and he was going to be the guy that they were going to talk about. So you know what? Everybody thinks it's very casual and impromptu, all these discussions during the games. I got to tell you, it's so much of it's prompted, you can't believe it. Even the guys down in the truck telling the announcers what to say during the game. That even happens. So, you know, it's almost like you're in an echo chamber and you're just repeating what somebody else said. You know what? I'm sorry. I don't care if that producer down the truck tells me something had happened. I know it didn't happen. You know, we're going to go to blows. I am not going to repeat what he told me to say. I'm going to say something
else. I like it.
Else.
I like it. That's what we like to hear of our analysts. Okay. 708 wants to know if the great John Fox can get the Bears ready to play on Monday night. And I think that's a good question about what does John Fox have to do to motivate a team that had this kind of Jekyll and Hyde performance in Houston?
You know what? This is a scary situation for a coach to be in. I've had a few teams that I've coached in the past before or been part of a staff that had this much change. Here's what we always thought of just from a coaching staff as far as a player goes. I don't really care how good a player is if he's got a huge range. In other words, Justin, if he shows up one night and he can do anything, and then the next week he can't do anything, his range, he's like on a bell curve, he's at the very top and at the very bottom. I want guys, their best and their worst performances are very narrow. So I know on his worst day, I can still win with that guy. Okay, he might be the best player in the league on certain days, but when he's bad, he's really, really bad.
Yeah.
And to me, it looked like that's what took place last weekend. You know, how does he change it? I don't know. I think delivery number one, you know, just getting honest with those players and start holding them accountable. And you can do it in a lot of different ways, in meetings, you know, calling players out. I tell you what, no player wants to be called out in front of the rest of the players. I mean, you talk about getting a chip on your shoulder, getting mad, getting angry, whatever. You know, that's the way. This is not a fun game to play. You go out and play football. Oh, I love playing football. No. During the game, this is life and death. And you're out there trying to protect the brand of the Chicago Bears and the longevity of your career.
All right. Well, Chicago Bears 0-1 in a division that unfortunately all three of the other teams won. They're 1-0. We open up on Monday Night Football. For you, Doug, I mean, for being a coach and a player, but when you get these primetime games, when you play in front of a national audience, is it different for the player? Do you get jacked up for the idea it's a home opener and it's on Monday Night Football?
Well, number one, everybody likes to say, coaches say, oh, it's the same. It doesn't matter. Well, let me tell you, over the last two seasons, the Bears have been 3-13 at home. They only won one home game last year. I promise you, if I was playing on this team or I was coaching on this football team, this would be a big deal to me. I'm treating this game like it's Super Bowl. We've got to win it. And there's a whole bunch of studies out there already that if you lose the first game of the year, how it adversely affects your ability to make the playoffs. And it's been proven for years and years in the National Football League. I'm not saying the Bears, it's over. No, but you know what? They cannot afford to lose against a good Philadelphia team. I mean, Philadelphia is very confident. They won very handily against the Browns their first game of the year. This is going to be a tough game, and the Bears better start getting ready right now.
All right, 773, we'll end it here. With love the segment. There will never be another safety like Doug Plank. Do you still keep in contact with Gary Fensick, and do you feel like you could play the style in which you played today in the NFL?
Gosh, you know what? I don't even know you know, what is legal now in terms of hit. You know, is it your intent or is it the way you actually contact players? I know there's a very small little zone now. And when I was a player, you know, they would call me, hey, Doug, you use your helmet too much. You ran and hit the player. But then we would go on offense and Walter Payton would use his helmet to run over everybody on defense.
Right.
I'm thinking, where is this fair? He just did 10 times in one play, which it might take me two games, you know, you hit that many guys. And so at least it's consistent now, you know, they'll call it on both offense and defense. It was such a thrill, you know, to have played both in college and especially for the Chicago Bears. And, but I don't know. I think my salary and the suspensions would probably be coming because, you know, I don't think I would change my style.
All right. And they want to know if you're still in contact with Gary Fensick.
Yes. You know, how can you not? I mean, Gary and I, when we see each other, it's like we just saw each other last week. I mean, the conversation just goes. We have such fantastic memories. Not that we need to keep rehashing them every time. But, you know, the respect level is off the charts. I mean, anytime that I ever felt like I got out of position, it is so nice to know you're out there playing with a guy that is not just playing his position, but he's adjusting to what you're doing. And I tried to do the same thing for him. If he went hard inside, I would take the outside. Or, but it was, a lot of it was not even communicated. You just did it instinctively.
Yeah.
And that's what playing with him was such a thrill.
Doug Plank, who joins us every Monday to break down the Bears game. He did so, even though this was a tough one, a tough loss for the Bears. He'll be back next week. I think we'll figure out Monday or Tuesday. We'll talk with you around the scheduled Monday Night Football next week. Doug Plank, thanks so much, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Justin. Hopefully a big win.
Big win. All right, coming up, Low Shut Up, the reunion here on WGN's Studio 435. Looking forward to this. A great indie rock band from, I would even say, the early 2000s, probably, right in that area. So we'll talk with them, and we'll hear some live music in studio coming up here at 10 o'clock. That was good talking to Doug. It's always fun, you know, when they ask for calls and questions, Pete, you know. All it is, what was it like to play with Gary Fensick?
No.
I'm like, you don't have any X's and O's? You don't have a question about, like, I don't know, Eddie Royal?
No. I don't care about that stuff.
They're like, you used to spear guys. What was that like? Like, all right. Doug Plank. How awesome is that, though? That's like one of my, I think about it, and there's this, like, I don't know what it is, people, and I get this real pump up because I've always been a big fan of radio in Chicago. And just it harkens back to a time when I'm like, I get excited to listen to the radio after a Bears game with OB and Hamp or OB and Doug back in the day or even before that. Just the way that there was just always this thing, this collective thing that we wanted to all talk about or complain about or celebrate. And it's great to be in a position where we can do that here on the Download with Doug Plank. I just think that's awesome.
It's the best.
Right? Isn't that cool? Yeah. Doesn't it give the same feel? Like, it's like you get jacked up for the idea that we're going to sort of collectively complain about the Bears. I was disappointed because I felt yesterday there wasn't a tremendous amount of fun, like unique quirky commercials to make fun of.
Well, unfortunately I watched the game this morning,
so you fast forward
according to having which is terrible, having known
It doesn't work.
You know, having known that they lost, I watched the entire game just to, you know, like, just want to see, you know, Tom Brenneman talking about, you know, Kanye West shoes, you know, things like that.
That's right, he did. He's wearing, I think those are the Yeezy collection. Do you get fined for wearing a Kanye West shoe, or you can?
He probably gets fined.
Yeah.
Knowing the NFL, I would assume. I'm gonna err on the side of getting fined.
I love the tweets today that I saw that people were getting fined for wearing different shoes and things they couldn't. Some that were honoring 9/11. Yeah, it's just like, come on. And then the tweet was like, well, Kaepernick doesn't stand up and he doesn't get fined. I'm like, well, it's a uniform violation, different than, you know, the national anthem. But I didn't see tonight on the Monday Night Football game if Colin Kaepernick.
But he took a knee.
Did he?
Yeah.
Okay.
49ers backup.
49ers. I know. That's the thing. It's like his agents are like, we need something to talk about that is going to get you back in the spotlight. And this might be it. So, a lot of protests yesterday at the around the league. You know, you saw the a couple other players take a knee. You saw teams united. I thought it was fine. I thought there was way too much. We talked about it on Friday. Way too overreported in the sense that, you know, I for one, as a fan, have not paid attention to all of the different ways that people stand or sit during the national anthem in my history of watching football.
No.
So there's no, like, I don't know if they all were standing. Like, I don't know. I don't care. And it's like the last thing I care about watching my sport is analyzing whether or not a football player should stand up. It's all right, good. Yeah, I heard there's some very eloquent sort of thoughts after the game from players that thought the kid in what's Foster, Arian Foster in Miami, and also the kid who Doug Baldwin, Seattle. They both were on ESPN afterwards and they were talking about why they protest. I thought it was great. I was like, that's great. There you go. We got it. Next.
Yep. What's next? Give me my fantasy stats.
Although, guys, we might want to go back to all the football protest talk after the fact that Ryan Lochte apparently was rushed on stage by a couple of protesters in his appearance with Dancing with the Stars.
Was he tonight?
So, you know, pick your poison here, because we're going to hear about this Lochte thing for about the next 3 weeks.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Wait. Kaepernick. I will not accept Colin Kaepernick. Just to get it back on point so we don't have to talk about Ryan Lochte. Oh, that's no good. So there's protesters of Ryan Lochte or just...
Of his dancing?
I don't know. It's yeah, the
it's breaking.
Details
it's
are
fluid,
sketchy.
Yeah.
Yes, mm-hmm. It's a fluid situation.
It's developing.
Exactly.
It's
yes.
developing.
It's a developing story.
I wonder what that does for the pool. Martyr and I, we're going to win it.
Wait, who do you have?
We have the gymnast. I don't know her name.
I don't know who I picked.
You and I are in the same.
It's like a random draw.
We're the teammates.
Yeah.
Oh.
And we picked the one women's gymnastics star.
Mary Lou Retton?
Not Retton, no, from this year.
Oh.
Hernandez. Lori Hernandez.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. I'll take
that. Everyone says that she could be a winner.
Sure.
So.
My reluctant pick was I got who I wanted. Kenneth Babyface Edmonds.
Nice. You got Babyface?
Yep. I choose my Dancing with the Stars people how my favorite road on I-65. Kenneth Babyface Edmonds.
Babyface Edmonds. I love it. All right. So we'll coming up, Studio 435 here on the Down and Low Shut Up in Studio, getting ready to go. Take a break. We'll get the news. We'll come back. Stay with us. It's the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, live here in the Allstate Showcase Studio. It's time for Studio 435, our Monday night jam session in the Allstate Showcase Studio. We feature Chicago bands, you should know. Tonight, no exception, the Chicago indie rock band Low Shut Up, which last was together in 2004. How about that? I mean, these guys were taking on the scene back in 2001, 2002, that kind of time frame. Is that about right? And they are back together. 2004 was the last. So that's 12 years. It's 12 years to think about. They're getting back to Chris Churchill, Tony Mendoza, Joanna Beese in studio tonight. The reunion. This is before any shows, anything like that. They're reunion. They're reuniting here on the download in Studio 435. Low Shut Up. Why don't we start with some music right away? Why don't we get to it? Chris, what's this song going to be?
This is one I think you know. It's called Trolley.
Oh, Trolley, one of my faves. Here we go. Trolley, Low Shut Up.
One, two, three. Everybody wants to ride the trolley. Everybody wants to ride it downtown. You don't have to stop and ride it for a couple blocks. Everybody wants to ride the trolley around. Everybody wants to ride the trolley, but I don't.
everybody wants, everybody wants to ride. Everybody wants, everybody wants, everybody wants to ride. Do you go to Navy Pier? Don't you see me laying here?
I now ride a bike.
I was lying on the floor.
I now ride a bike.
And you come knocking on my door.
I now ride a bike.
I was trying to take a break.
I now ride a bike.
I guess I'll drive you in the lake.
Shut up in studio. Still live in studio 435 here on 720 WGN. Chris Churchill, Joanna Beese, and Tony Mendoza here reunited after all these years. It feels so good, right? All right, why don't we do this? Why don't we take a quick break, if that's okay, Pete? We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll get these guys around the table. We'll talk about what it takes to get back together after 12 years' time and hear some more music from Chicago's indie rockers. Los Shut Up. Stay with us. It's Studio 435 here on the download, WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, Chicago indie rockers Los Shut Up, a band that really was, I mean, you guys were on stage performing and recording music for a couple of years. I want to say like 2000, 2004, that kind of area.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Yes.
So 4 years together, 12 years off. They're back together. And before they book any shows, they decide to come to Studio 435 first. Chris Churchill, that's Joanna Beese, Tony Mendoza in studio with me tonight. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thank you
for having us.
Let's talk about this. I mean, first, why don't we go back to 2000? What were the origins of bringing a band together? Because you all three were in comedy, and that's how I know you guys. Mm-hmm. It's great to see you guys again. But I mean, you guys are an improv comedy. What was the idea of putting a band together and truly doing music as opposed to just straight up improv comedy?
I think originally me and Tony were working at the trolley company.
Yeah, that's where we met.
And I think I was in the mode of like every shiny object looked great at the time, you know. And I don't mean that as a, but I meant like I came here with the plan of I was going to do comedy,
right?
You know, and I did the whole Second City IO thing, you know. But I saw there was a band that was making lots of at the trolley company. Some guys, I was like, hey, I could do that. And then so me and Tony, we're going to play. And then we stole their bass player, and then he was with us for a year before he couldn't handle the two of us anymore.
I knew Tony separately from improv, and then I knew Chris independently also from improv, but I didn't know you two knew one another, and the fates brought us all together.
Yeah, you know, when you go out to those comedy improv clubs, I should say, every night, and you're just, you run into the same people over and over again, and, you know, you're drinking, and then you end up in a band.
Well, this is what happens every time.
It is interesting because there's an innate creativity for people who can do improv and do it well, and the three of you can, and you also have the skills to be musical. So it's just, it is sort of, you know, the building of community. That's the building blocks of it, the idea that it's not just what you're doing on stage at that place. It's the idea of the three of you finding something in common and being able to express yourself in a different form.
Yeah, I always feel really lucky when I get a chance to play music with people who also do comedy or improv or anything like that, because it means that you don't have to panic at any time on stage ever, because guess what? Three strings just broke on my guitar. It's time for Tony to read a letter from home, you know, or whatever silly, dumb thing we'd throw in to kill the time. That would eventually become a bit that we would do regularly, you know, because we did eventually after we stopped. I mean, we didn't stop. Let me straighten that out. Joanna joined the band a year in, okay? And once we realized we all three, you know, comedy folks, we started making that part of the show. Before it was just straight rock, right?
Yeah.
When Joanna added it, we realized, okay, we have a real strength
here. So the stage show became more of a, had more improv elements in it than just sort of straight up music.
Yeah, on account of me.
On account of her.
There you go. Go figure.
Yeah, it's true. Go figure it.
Well,
we, and then we had a featured, we were, you know, I forgot to bring this up in our reunion rehearsals, but we had a featured performance spot at the Chicago.
Chemically Imbalanced Comedy.
Chemically Imbalanced Comedy.
Yeah, because I was a resident artist with them in the early days when they were just getting started, and they had us do, and of course, we weren't doing the full rock setup then. And this is one of the sheer strokes of Tony Mendoza genius that came out of this whole thing. Is we, you know, he's a drummer, and you can't, that drums and a big amp, it's not going to fit into the old Frankie J's space, whatever it's called now, you know, when we used to have
carry spot.
Yeah, the spot. Who knows what it is now?
Tiny room, right. Like 20 people.
Decibel.
And
is it decibel?
The crowd is like on top of you.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So you don't want to blow them away with amplifiers and all that stuff.
Right.
So I found this toy drum kit, an electronic toy drum kit in the garbage.
It.
Yeah. Like the whatever in the alley, you know, and then I played it with carrots because we would go to the supermarket before shows.
So instead of drumsticks, we would there would be carrots all over the stage.
Oh, that's
they'd,
right,
they'd break quickly.
Disaster.
The carrots would break. That's right. Often.
Yeah. Where does I mean, you guys obviously met through improv, but where does your musical influences come from? I know you, Chris, for a long time, and I know that you're a Ween fan.
Oh yeah,
and
sure,
I know that you can feel that presence in the band and they'll shut up in the way that is. But where does the influences come for what we heard, like with Trolley?
Well, yeah. My stuff was at that time, so we were coming off of the 90s then, so I was really into, at that time, Pavement and those indie rock bands. My drumming influence was The Who and Ringo and... That was about it, really.
Who and Ringo?
Keith Moon. I know who the drummer The Who is.
I'd say my role in this is purely functional. My... music history was piano. I took piano lessons. Mrs. Tooman was a wonderful piano teacher for many years. She's passed away, but that's
what he was booing. He was booing her down.
Tony,
that's what I was booing.
So I had music, you know, growing up, but I'd never picked up a bass before this band.
Really?
Yeah.
I bought it for you on your birthday.
You did. Thank you.
It was a weird kind of a passive aggressive.
It was like, here's this bass, play in the band. Joanna.
Happy birthday. Join the band.
Which, of course, was kind of like, at the time, me and Tony, so the song Trolley was something that was sort of collaborated on between me and Tony and the first bass player. We all three worked at Trolley, you know. But when he left, we were like looking for someone to fill, and we tried a keyboard player that didn't work out. We tried a bass player that I had known before, and turned out he was just kind of a dud, and people just kept disappearing.
I don't remember any of this.
I remember the dud.
Who doesn't remember the dud?
But during this time, we were only rehearsing with them. We weren't doing any shows with them for about, I don't know, 6 months or so. It was just me and Tony. And so I was trying to use my classical guitar skills to play, you know, point, counterpoint, bass, and lead at the same time kind of thing. Trying to be awesome.
And hilarious.
And hilarious at the same time. How do I do it? But yeah, but then Tony, you guys were dating. I don't think we said that, right?
Oh, cat's out of the bag now.
You were dating back then, right? At that time, they were dating.
Right.
And I, at the time when Joanna was going to become our bass player, I was happy and nervous at the same time because I thought, wait a minute, he's just getting his girlfriend to play bass in our band. But turns out Joanna's awesome on multiple levels.
Yeah. All right. And then a lot of these recordings that we're listening to were recorded about, 3-4 days after we broke up?
Oh, yeah.
So
really?
That was a hoot.
That was rough.
Spending.
So you did the recordings after the breakup?
Yeah, that's right.
It was like the weekend.
What was that like? I mean, but talk about that. It's funny, obviously, 12 years later as we think about it, but the idea, was it difficult to be able to create music together in that environment?
Yeah. It was kind of horrible.
It was
horrible.
Yeah, it was horrible.
Yeah.
It was a hard thing.
I'd also lost my job in that same week. I was canned from my job, and it was...
Oh, that was awful.
Yeah.
That was a tough week. So we went into the studio.
So we decided
to record a love song.
So we just hunkered down and...
Why? I mean, at a certain point with that happening in the band, was there any thought to say, okay, let's put this on the back burner. Let's not record. Let's try. Let's decide to just.
You would think that would have been
right.
The thing.
Yeah. Well, but, right? But then yeah. It turns out that we had this other, we had a second guitarist for a long time who's hard to sort of pin down.
You could only do one weekend.
Tony was very, very thrilled that she was going to be available that very weekend. So he's like, yeah. We got to do this. Let's
yeah,
get
Holly.
It.
Yeah, Holly. Holly Lipper. She's Holly a great Lipper. Guitarist. Yeah. She was in the band at the time.
We wish she were here.
And yeah, I just knew, I was like, oh, I don't think Holly's going to be in this band for too much longer.
We better get these songs.
It's a tough dynamic to exist within. I'll give that to anybody who walks into the room with the three of us.
Well, I mean, okay, so that was, I mean, the recordings happened, and then, you know, what was the timeline before you guys broke up? Was it like, was the band on the way out at that point?
No.
A year at least.
Another couple years, yeah.
And we lasted another 2 years. Yeah. At least another two years.
Actually, it was kind of interesting. Like, when we broke up, we had just come off doing the Second City Unhinged Festival. Like, it was right around that time. We did that in 2004.
Yeah.
And it was like six Tuesdays in a row or something at the ETC
space. It was
space.
A little run, right.
Yeah. It was cool. It was fun. It was like a little variety / rock thing. You could tell half the people in the crowd were not expecting us at a Second City show. But at any rate, we did it, and we had a great time, and we used that money to go and record the next EP, and it was like, I mean, it was real shortly after we recorded that next EP that Tony, I mean, you decided you just didn't want to do this anymore.
I guess that's what that was.
We were
at
Bad Dog Tavern.
There's a plug.
Yeah.
If you're a band looking to break up, Bad yeah. Dog Tavern, yeah, yeah. Great.
We were having dinner, and Tony dropped it on us.
And me too? Was I there?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember it, yeah.
We were having what'd those green beans that they used to serve with.
The crispy beans.
Yeah, the crispy beans.
Oh, those beans. Let's get some.
They were good. I don't think they're there anymore.
We should head over to Bag. Tony's like, you know, we should head over there right after the show. I'd love to talk to you guys again.
I'd love to talk to you guys about.
About this beans, 12 year. Man. So 12 years ago, Los Shut Up broke up. Mm-hmm. They're back together here for a reunion tour. I mean, are we going to see some shows coming out from you guys? I mean, what's the plan?
We have a couple of things in the hopper. Basically, when the album comes out, which is the thing we did release, plus the thing we didn't release, remastered, plus a couple of extra things we've thrown on, when that is released on Mint 400 Records, we will do a release show. I talked to Jim Weber at North Bar, and he is totally up for doing it anytime. We just haven't decided when.
Okay. All right.
And then other than that, this filming thing we're doing here is kind of for my own purposes, but it also involves documentary type work.
All right, so there you go.
Whether we're getting
Tony Mendoza, Joanna Beese, Chris Churchill, they are Los Shut Up. They're going to perform again coming up here after the news. Let's take a break. It's Studio 435. Stay with us. All right, it's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Time for Studio 435. It's Monday nights at 10 o'clock. Our jam session in the Allstate Showcase Studio. We feature Chicago bands you should know. And tonight, Los Shut Up. Is that the preferred way to say it? Los Shut Up.
Yeah, that's exactly.
That's exactly how you guys do it.
Yeah,
3-2.
The Chicago indie rock band that recorded and performed live all over Chicago from 2000 to 2004 broke up. They're back together 12 years later. It's Chris Churchill, Joanna Beese, and Tony Mendoza. They're here in studio. What are we going to hear now? What do we got, guys?
This is a love song that was written called "That's Love," and then we broke up, and we had to record it.
There it is. That's Love here in Studio 435. Los Shut Up.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Woo-hoo. I woke up this morning. You woke up too. We've both been snoring. And that's love. It's a groovy, groovy kind of love. Back roads, we got that back roads bingo, enjoying
a groovy, groovy kind of love. Who let the dogs out? Yeah, we could get a pontoon boat and a French fry machine. Pretend it's Halloween. I guess I love you. You love me too. Let's never get married.
Yeah. So there you go. Los Shut Up in studio. Come sit down over at the table, guys. Chris Churchill, Tony Mendoza, Joanna Beezy in studio. Live, Studio 435 here on Michigan Avenue. The reuniting of Los Shut Up, whose last EP was put out in 2004, right? Was sort of the end of it.
Actually, we never put it out.
We never put out the last one.
Yeah, so that's what this
that's
record
what
release
this is all about.
Is,
it's kind of like,
so you guys are going to put that one out?
Highly anticipated.
Yeah. Do you go in and redo it, or do you say, okay, we're going to put those tracks together and we're just going to put them out like they were in 2004?
We're gonna get it mastered. Much to my consternation, our first thing, we never mastered it. It's just there it is. Yeah, it sounds 20 decibels quieter than anything else you listen to, and that was So we're taking everything we recorded and getting it mastered, and so it sounds good.
For you guys, I mean, what's the emotion of getting back together 12 years later? Because, I mean, obviously you guys were bandmates, you were together, you were friends. What's it like to get back together in a band 12 years later?
We're older now.
Yeah, we did determine that. Older. We figured that one out pretty quick.
I mean, I guess that goes. But you know what I mean by older. I guess that just means... No. I don't know. You know,
I know what you mean. There's this sort of bittersweetness of... looking back at 12 years like it happened yesterday, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, a whole lot of life has happened in between 2004 and now. I mean, Tony's been in 17 other bands, right? You know, and he kept doing were doing comedy and stuff for a while, right? No, I was doing sketch comedy for a while. I did a few plays, you know, and I keep doing, I keep doing a lot of different stuff, and life just keeps going.
Yeah, we're all married now. That's weird.
Yeah.
I mean, it's great, individually great. It's and weird. Time passes.
All three of us are married to each other.
Yeah, that's what the reunion is, Chris.
You didn't know.
Yeah, you didn't know. We have to drink a special potion.
I mean, the band has a certain spirit to it in the way that it's very quirky. It's very indie. It's there. You can tell the improv comedy roots that come through the songwriting that brings us a little Shut Up. Hey, you think that changes with age? Do you think that you guys get together and create new music that it might be a little different in the way that you approach it based on your life's experiences?
Yeah,
I would
probably.
Say yeah, yeah.
Probably.
I don't write those kind of songs anymore. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know that I ever consciously wrote Low Shut Up songs. I was always just writing my songs and hoping they would work for Low Shut Up, you know? And sometimes they did and sometimes they didn't, you know? But I think now I kind of can see this reunion as it is as being like Low Shut Up is its own thing. Certain things work for this trio and certain things don't. Certain, you know, times of our life work for this trio and sometimes don't. The great thing about being older is you don't have to look at it as it's the only thing going in your life. If this doesn't work tonight, I'm going to go kill myself. I'm going to go throw all my equipment off the bridge, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
Like when you're in your 20s and your emotions are a lot higher than you are when you're in your 40s, you know.
No,
I
agree with that. Yeah. We used to get into all these crazy like you and your blah, me and my blah. And now it's just like, okay, man, let's get a cup of coffee together at the Alexander's.
Ding, ding.
Oh, yeah. You seem calmer, Tony.
I'm definitely calmer.
Yeah. Say that out.
And I'm medicated finally, so that's good.
Okay, so we know that Tony's calmer, Chris is medicated. Joanna, how are you different?
Yeah. I'm like a rock. I'm steady Eddie all the way through all these years. Not a lot of wavering.
Let me ask you this. There's Libra. A dynamic between Chris and Tony. And as you just mentioned, there's a lot of sort of getting at each other's throats, and there's a lot of sort of, you know, artistic differences and artistic arguments about where the direction for you to be in the band and have to put up with that.
Yeah.
What role do you play in that? And B, what is your sort of viewpoint and your philosophy when it comes to the being in this sort of sphere with these gentlemen?
I guess my philosophy is just to, as a younger sibling in my family dynamics, just to try to antagonize, I guess, as much as I can, or like play sides too, like, or play like, some days Chris is the A number one guy, Chris is my guy, other days Tony's my guy and Chris is on the on the list. So.
Well, yeah, when I came to pick them up today, I was the guy that had to get everybody's equipment and load it all into the van and then pick everybody up. So
I sat in the back seat playing with my phone.
Well, Chris sat in the back seat. He didn't sit in the front seat. He sat in the back. I drove Chris.
So I joined him. So I joined Chris in the back seat.
Right. So I'm driving them around, and then when I pull up to Joanna's house, she's got a driveway that's on a 90-degree angle, so your car loses its muffler.
I want to pretend like I'm in San Francisco when I drive home.
Anyway, so I'm like, kind of got steam coming out of my ears while I'm picking these guys up, and she starts making fun of me and goofing around, and it broke the ice. It kind of put things into perspective, and I too could laugh at it after I yelled at them.
I'm glad that I
love it.
Serve that function. For you, Tony.
The band is low shut up. The trio is in studio. They are back. They're mastering, they're remastering their EP, and they're going to be hitting up some shows coming up here in 2016, 2017. Let's take a quick break, and can we get one more out of you guys?
Absolutely.
All right, we'll do one more here at Studio 435. Stay with us. All right, welcome back to Download here at Studio 435, our Monday night jam session in the Allstate Showcase Studio featuring Chicago bands you should know. Tonight, Los Shut Up, the indie rock band that broke up in 2004. They're back together 12 years later, 2016. Expect a remastered EP and some shows coming up soon. Los Shut Up is Chris Churchill, Joanna Beezy, and Tony Mendoza. All right, so this song we're going to hear is called Chocolate Sauce. It's the final performance tonight, Studio 435. Here they are, Los Shut Up.
Reasoning. I feel this note in Dorito seasoning. I don't know which of my thoughts is boss. I get my love from this chocolate sauce. Wouldn't be so sad if I wasn't so tired. I need iron, copper, and my friendly wife. And one of our dogs ate one of my shoes. And celebrities always changing their views. And politicians, they always lie. I cross my heart and hope to die. I don't know which of my thoughts is lost. I get my love from this chocolate sauce. Wouldn't be so sad if I wasn't so tired. I need iron, copper, and my friendly wife. Popeye's love of spinach is to be admired. Popeye's love of spinach
is to be admired. It's tough to be tough, I don't mean to be mean. My emotional strength comes from caffeine. I've not motivated myself in years, but I need Visine to activate my tears. I don't know which of my thoughts is boss. I get my love from this chocolate sauce. Wouldn't be so sad if I wasn't so tired. I need iron and copper and my brain rewired. Popeye's love of spinach is to be admired. 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 I would gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today. I would gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today. I would gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today. Would gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today.
Yeah, there we go. Hello, shut up. In studio tonight, Studio 435, the song Chocolate Sauce, Chris Churchill, Joanna Beezy, and Tony Mendoza. Why don't you guys come up back on the mics and we'll wrap it up. Have you guys here in studio. A show coming up here soon, as well as remastering their EP.
Tony, hurry up, back on the mics.
He'll make it, he'll make it. Here I come. He's a drummer, he'll get here.
He's a drummer.
Gotta get out of my cage.
He's got his own beat.
Since I have all three of you guys here, I mean, we've known each other for so long. I mean, Joanna, you're still doing shows with Sirens.
For sure,
Chris,
yeah.
I had you on not too long ago talking about your play, about waiting for a play. Uh-huh. Tony, what are you up to?
I make videos for my new band called The French Goodbye, and I make other little videos, like little web series. You know, everything I do is very small and little.
Very little.
Yeah. But yeah, I did a web series called Winner or Loser, about a delivery driver who's deciding if he's a winner or a loser based on daily events.
For all three of you, I mean, you have spent your lives here mostly in Chicago, you know, it's mostly in the improv scene, and obviously doing music with Low Shut Up. But talk about, I've been hearing more and more, and whether it be Facebook and other people talking about improv and the idea that improv has made their lives better, you know. And as we all have sort of come up at the same time and performed countless different shows, and you guys have been able to translate improv into what you do with Low Shut Up. Is that true? Has improv made your life a better life, Chris?
In general, yeah. I mean, every once in a while you come off as an improv nerd to somebody. But I'm talking about as a skill in life, absolutely.
As an ethos.
As an ethos, absolutely.
As a philosophy.
Absolutely. Life is improv. Improv is life. That was my old improv group in Kansas City before I moved up here. That was their thing, you know?
What do you think, Tony?
Oh, yeah. Totally. I think I do. I think everyone should take an improv class. I think it would just open your mind to change. Like, the world changes before, you know, the world changes. And so improv helps you deal with that.
Certainly makes things easier if you're like, oh, let's agree to what's happening instead of fighting one another and putting up roadblocks and not moving things forward in a, like, positive way. You know,
listening is a huge thing. Yeah. So yeah, it's like the fundamental basic building blocks of how to be a
collaborative artist.
Yeah,
as well. Yeah,
yeah, with art or with anything. You know. Yeah, and my wife does things at Northwestern with early onset Alzheimer's patients, and she's incorporating improv into that. And yeah, so it's got this altruistic thing you can do with it. You know, aside from, you know, making people laugh, it can do other things.
Healing.
You betcha.
For you, all three of you, you've also chosen. I mean, you find ways to pay the bills, but I mean, your artistic expression is through our creative adventures like Low Shut Up or improv shows like Sirens for years. I mean, talk about that choice that you've made in your life to be artists, to continue to find projects here in a big city, and how that's affected you. I mean, Chris, could you see yourself working in an office? Could you be an office guy?
I was an office guy. I worked for the Federal Reserve Bank for 4 years. I don't know if you knew that about me.
And I loved it.
But I got a crazy idea that I needed to go do work some crazy schedule and got stuck driving a trolley for 18 years, which I love, but right. I'm in grad school to try and get something else. Anyway, yes. What was the question?
No, the question is just the artist life. I mean, you live in Chicago, you live in a big city.
It would break my heart.
You chose this life.
Yeah, it would break my heart if I was told that I couldn't do some kind of creative outlet, some kind of artistic thing. If I didn't always have some project going outside of normal day-to-day life, I would be kind of depressed and sad. And it's not that I'm trying to get anywhere or make it. It's just you got to have some kind of creative goal, something to work on. Or it's like you don't want to kill your dreams, you know. And I don't mean like dreams of again of making it big somewhere. I just mean dreams of creating things, you know. Don't want to kill it.
Doing different things too. I feel like is really important. If I did only improv, first of all, I'd only perform probably once a year when Sirens does a run. But like pulling out the old bass after many years has been a gas.
Good.
And I'm going to say it honestly and openly in front of all these witnesses that I love you guys. No, it's been very fun. It's been really, yeah. It's fun. And I've been.
I love you guys as well.
Oh, yeah, guys.
Yeah. So three on that. I love you too. Right. And no, but she picked up the bass like real quick again. It's funny how things just whoop.
Yeah.
After 12 years, like, bang, bang, you can do it again.
Yeah.
For you guys in the fingers. All having the opportunity to come up and sustain your lives, your creative lives in Chicago, what does Chicago offer you? Is this a creative town? Is it a good town to be an artist in?
Yes. It's ever shifting, like what the focus is on what's, you know, the hot thing to be an artist in Chicago. But that always gives you something to comment on and something to react to as an artist. So it's cool in that way.
Yeah, it's a great town. Yeah, it will always be an artistic town, I think, aside from and in addition to all the other things that, it, you know, that everyone knows it for. Oprah and Al Capone or whatever. Right. You know what I'm talking about.
I remember the show they did. But
I was going to riff on that, but we don't have time. No, it's a good town, and they're filming a lot here right now. There's so many shows. Dick Wolf has taken over everything, and there's other things going on besides that too. Oh, so, 7 seconds. Yeah.
There's tons of stuff going on. I got a master's degree at Columbia in interdisciplinary arts, and there are people doing things with art and science together, and art like it's all over the place, and. That was a really awesome thing to say.
Art is magic.
In the last few minutes.
Art is magic. Yeah. Low Shut Up, one of my favorite bands, reunited after 12 years. They're going to be remastering their EP, Look For It, as well as shows that will be coming up here 2016-2017. Chris Churchill, Joanna Beezy, and Tony Mendoza. Great to see you guys. And
thank you.
I'm glad that you're back
you.
Together. And thanks for performing tonight.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Had fun.
That's going to do it tonight for The Download. Patty Vasquez up next with Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez. Thanks to Bob Ferguson, as always, for engineering the Studio 435 segment. We'll be back tomorrow. Now, we got a great show tomorrow. There's people coming through. I'll say it. I'm not afraid to say it. Second City veteran and tremendous, tremendous comedic performer Fred Willard joins us tomorrow night. How about that? The whole band. Ooh. Yeah, he's in town for the Fifth Star Awards. Also, blues great Shamika Copeland will join us as well, and Neil Steinberg with his new book. So we've got a jam-packed show tomorrow night here on The Download.